light up, take what's there. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn, talking about the revolution.
This Week in Radical History for the week of July 14th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot Organizer, some audio borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York, and more radical info came from the Daily Bleed website.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes.
This week in radical history, starting July 14th, 1764, Conspiracy of the Equals member and precursor to the French anarchist Jean-Francisque Vallée is born. Vallée hated the dictator who, in essence, took over the French Revolutionary government and his excesses, as well as the middle-class running of the country after King Louis is deposed. Speaking of the French Revolution, happy Bastille Day. In 1798, storming the Bastille heralds the French Revolution, begun by Parisian crowds seeking arms and the liberation of political prisoners. It signals a new period in history with the taking of power by the capitalist class and French bourgeoisie. The people of Paris stormed the prison of Bastille, symbol of tyranny, federal authority, and divine right of kings. The revolution creates a formidable enthusiasm not only among the French working class but also around the world. Unfortunately, the middle class gains control, its power displayed in a basket of guillotines and totalitarian temptations, leading to reaction and empire and various wars of conquest, all in the name of freedom and revolution. In our own revolutionary freedom-loving country in 1798, Federalist Sponsor Sedition Act made it a crime to write, utter, or publish any false, scandalous, or malicious statements about the government, Congress, or the president. Anyone open against the government throughout the country were promptly arrested. Let freedom ring. On July 14th, 1811, working-class people around England start to organize against what they see as business taking advantage of them with their expensive machines. Known as the Luddites, the workers organize and have nighttime raids on business-owned machine shops. The government quickly moves to make it a capital crime to destroy machinery. Also on this date in 1912, Woody Guthrie, people songwriter, is born. Woody crisscrosses the nation, living and singing among the dispossessed. Over the course of his life, he composed over 1,000 ballads and celebrated, in his songs and his prose, the great human spirit. His songs included This Land Is Your Land, Bound for Glory, Union Made, and other American revolutionary classics. On July 14, 1916, federal authorities demand removal of the office of anarchist journal Mother Earth from its location at 20 East 125th Street in New York. Being good anarchists and not wanting to violate the letter of the law, they promptly moved the Mother Earth offices down the street. Also on July 14, 1935, black Americans in Harlem, New York, begin demonstrating in support of Ethiopian struggle against Italian fascism. They also start to organize volunteer brigades to go over and fight. Also on that date, 1937, because of high casualties while fighting the fascists in Spain, predominantly anarchist volunteers in the Lincoln and Washington battalions merge into one brigade, known as the Lincoln Brigade. Lastly, for July 14, 1998, 28 food not bombs and homeless activists arrested in San Francisco United Nations Plaza during a nonviolent direct action demonstration seeking to reclaim public space and parks, which is increasingly being made inaccessible to homeless people. This week in radical history for July 15th, 1205, Pope Innocent III says Jews are doomed to perpetual servitude and subjugation due to the crucifixion of Jesus, a view still held by many religious kooks such as Mel Gibson to this day. Also on July 15, 1963 in New York, anti-draft riots end after 3 days. Over 1,000 dead in riots, including many free blacks, attacked and murdered by Confederate sympathizers. Of course, if you had enough money, you could buy your way out of the draft. Not much has changed in military service to this day. More news in the land of the free in 1917. Alexander Berkman and Emma Goldman and many others indicted under the new Espionage Act for their anti-draft activities. Berkman and Goldman would get 2 years in prison and fined $10,000. Also on July 15, 1917, 50,000 lumberjacks strike for an 8-hour workday. Also on that date in 1918, U.S. intelligence agencies begin to circulate the names and addresses of over 8,000 Mother Earth subscribers, targeting them for investigations. Reluctantly, they decide it is better to close a Mother Earth bookstore than to let the government continue to harass anarchist subscribers. On this date in 1919, the U.S. War Department announces that it is classifying more than 337,000 American men as draft dodgers. Also on that date in 1958, Marines invade Lebanon to protect American interests. Also on July 15, 1974, appearing live on a Florida TV station, newswoman Christine Chubbuck finishes reading the news to her Florida audience and says, "And now, in keeping with Channel 4D's policy of always bringing you the latest blood and guts, in full color you're about to see another first, an attempted suicide," unquote. Reaching into a shopping bag behind her desk, she pulls out a revolver and shoots herself in the head. Propaganda the deed on live TV. Two more items for July 15, 1978. The longest walk, transcontinental walk by Native American Justice, begun on February 11th, arriving in Washington, D.C. on this date from Alcatraz Island, with over 30,000 marchers. Also on that date, 1985, animal rights activists begin a sit-in in the National Institute of Health to protest funding of experimental head injury lab at the University of Pennsylvania, where they'd be willing to bludgeon monkeys in the head for the research. This week in radical history for July 16th, 1099, following Christ's teaching of love thy neighbor, crusaders herd the Jews of Jerusalem into a synagogue and set it afire. Also on July 16th, 1439, in England, a kissing ban is enforced in an attempt to stop the spread of pestilence and disease. The prohibitions fail as people only pay it lip service. It's all kind of tongue-in-cheek. Also on July 16th, 1835, 2,400 Cherokees shipped out of Montgomery, Alabama, for the Arkansas River as part of the forced relocation of all Indians and U.S. territories west of the Mississippi River. Basic consolidation of over a century of the theft of all Indian lands to the east, primarily through bribery, theft, murder, cheating, and looting, and an unending string of broken legal treaties. Preparations for more of the same to come to the west in coming decades. Also on July 16th, the Great Railroad Strike of 1877 begins, with a wildcat strike of 30 railroad firemen in Martinsburg, West Virginia, protesting wage cutbacks and escalating into 2 weeks of national workers' rebellion against the railroad industry and federal government. Riots killed dozens in the Midwest and East Coast, and strikers briefly seized the city governments of Pittsburgh and St. Louis. Workers without unions to tame and control them successfully stopped the trains for 3 to 4 days, to as much as a week, while destroying and seizing property and even, quote, managing, unquote, as if it was their own. Also on July 16, 1927, Nicaragua, first collective aerial bombing in history by U.S. warships occur as a precursor to the invasion of that country to protect American interests.
No more Iraqs, no more Kosovos, no more El Salvadors. These are not isolated incidents of stupidity. They're part of a long, bloody history of foreign policy being conducted for the financial interests of the wealthy few. It violates our Constitution, it endangers our national security, it mortgages our future, it sacrifices our children. It must stop. The men and women in our armed forces protect our borders and our people, not the financial interests of Folgers, Chiquita Banana, Exxon, and Halliburton.
No, Virginia, there is no Santa Claus, no Great Pumpkin, no Easter Bunny, and no Tooth Fairy. And as though that weren't bad enough, here's another shocker. The U.S. government has done some bad things over the years and will almost certainly continue to do them in the years ahead. Foreign policy has very little to do with morality. And as long as any action can be justified by explaining that it was performed in the national interest, that will continue to be the case. And so we give support to repressive governments in South Korea and Brazil and Chile because it is in our national interest to do so. We will supply sophisticated weapons to backward countries and betray an entire people like the Kurds, all because it is in our national interest. What may be difficult to accept is that there's nothing new about that. In fact, it's what we hire our Secretary of State and our Foreign Service to do for us. The myth is that since the First World War, we were ever able to conduct our foreign policy any other way. And at best, it is naive, at worst, hypocritical. That they don't understand what's involved in that harsh reality. I'm Ted Koppel in New York.
Also on July 16, 1934, beginning the San Francisco General Strike, 127,000 workers participate. A longshoreman strike spreads and becomes a two-day general strike, paralyzing and forcing a settlement by the government and the capitalists. Also on this date in 1936 in Barcelona, Spain, the anarcho-trade unionists of the powerful CNT starts to distribute weapons to the workers to counter the intimate threat of the right-wing military coup, and the Spanish Civil War begins. Quoting them, "We had a clear impression that if the politicians feared fascism, they'd fear even more the people armed." Read George Orwell's Homage to Catalonia for a great book about the anarchist times in Spain.
People, the time has come.
This is your Radio Root supporter, Hannah George.
On this day, July 16th in 1944, 11 years before Rosa Parks, a 27-year-old black woman named Irene Morgan refused to give up her seat to a white passenger on a Greyhound bus. The driver stopped the bus in Virginia and summoned the sheriff, who dragged her off the bus. Although Morgan resisted the sheriff, she was eventually arrested and charged for resisting arrest and violating Virginia's segregation law. Morgan took her case to the Supreme Court, and 2 years later, it was decided that segregation on interstate travel was unconstitutional. Despite this ruling, southern states refused to accept the desegregation of interstate buses and trains.
A couple more items for July 16th, 1945. The first atomic bomb explodes in Trinity Site, New Mexico. Never given notice to the civilians living downrange from the site, days later the U.S. would drop two nuclear bombs in Japan. The U.S. is the only country in the world to use nukes on civilian population. Also on this day in 1946, notices are tacked to the doors of black churches in Georgia, reading, "The first nigger who votes in Georgia will be dead nigger." True Southern hospitality. Also in 1973, in another obvious violation of international law, the Senate Armed Service Committee begins probed into allegations that the U.S. Air Force had made 3,500 secret B-52 bombing raids into the neutral country of Cambodia. Lastly, on this date in 1987, Nicaragua, in the first major action since Ali North's effort to make them folk heroes, the Contras kill three children and a pregnant woman. Ronald Reagan illegally financed these Contras and argued that the American citizens should aid them, bizarrely comparing them to the Abraham Lincoln Brigade of the 1930s, the American primarily anarchists who fought against Franco and the fascist insurgents. These are the same Contras who ran drug rings to finance their attempts to overthrow the legal government. This day in radical history for July 17, 1794, the Whiskey Rebellion begins with a mob of 500 armed men protesting a new excise tax on small distilleries, but not large government-influenced and controlled distilleries, clash with troops at Fort Pitt. Within 3 weeks, 15,000 uniformed U.S. militia enter into the fray after the strikers fired upon U.S. revenues collector and burned down his home. This would be the largest internal fighting since the founding of the country. Also on July 17, 1862, Congress authorized President Lincoln to accept blacks for military service. U.S. Army can use blacks as laborers as well. Over 186,000 African Americans serve in the Union Army, with 38,000 losing their lives fighting the South's slave owners. Also on that date in 1917, the Justice Department instructs the attorneys and special agents to keep tabs on local Wobblies, IWW, Industrial Workers of the World, and ascertain their plans, sources of income, and any data that might link them to anti-war activities. No incriminating evidence surfaces, however. It was the FISA bill of its time.
People, the time has come. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, July 17th in 1944, a huge explosion at the Port Chicago Naval Ammunitions Base in California killed 320 Navy men and injured 390 others, the majority of whom were black. World War II was a particularly controversial time for black soldiers in the U.S. Armed Forces, which were still heavily segregated. Many black enlistees were assigned to Port Chicago to load highly explosive materials onto Navy ships, despite being untrained for this task. They encountered rampant racism and poor work conditions and were deliberately uninformed of the dangers they faced. The month following the explosion, black sailors at Port Chicago staged the Port Chicago Mutiny in an attempt to resist the Navy's racist policies.
Two more items for July 17, 1997, Italy. Cops raid anarchist centers and homes across the country. The Italian Anarchist Federation denounces the raids as a thinly veiled attempt to intimidate and criminalize the movement. Also in 1998, New York Times reveals reports admit CIA worked hand-in-hand with drug trafficking around the country. This week in radical history for July 18th, I got four items. 1879, Rose Pastor Stokes is born. She'd eventually be sentenced to 10 years for writing anti-war letter to the editor. Also on July 18th, 1913, book burning in Seattle, Washington, as sailors destroy the IWW, Industrial Workers of the World, Union Hall, busting windows and burning books they found there. These guardians of freedom, liberty, and the American way also ransacked the Socialist Party headquarters. Also on that date, 1969, proving no one is above the law, Senator Ted Kennedy offers Mary Jo Kopchne a lift home at the Chappaquiddick, Massachusetts. Kennedy drives off a dike bridge, killing an unmarried 28-year-old passenger. Kennedy left the scene of the accident and reported nothing to police until the following day.
People, the time has come. This is your Radio Roots reporter, Hannah George. On this day, July 19th in 1979, the Sandinista National Liberation Front overthrew the Nicaraguan dictator Anastasio Somoza Debayle. The U.S. had appointed his father as head of the newly established Nicaraguan National Guard in 1933, which had been established by the U.S. Marines as they withdrew from Nicaragua after 7 years of occupation. The Somoza family quickly took over the country, representing the wealthy Nicaraguan elite and U.S. interests for most of its corrupt 46-year reign, and violently squashing any political resistance by murdering thousands of citizens. Many members of the family were educated and received military training in the U.S. and regularly assisted the U.S. with imperialist political and military ventures in the region. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
This week in Radical History, on July 19th, we only have one item, 1692. In a land based on religious freedoms, 5 Massachusetts women are executed for witchcraft. Quickly this week in Radical History for July 20th, we only have a couple items. 1848, the Declaration of Sentiments begin the women's suffrage movement in New York. Also on July 20th, 1874, General Custer and his first official exploration expedition enters the Black Hills with 150 wagons and 1,000 men in direct violation of the Treaty of 1869 that barred whites from sacred hills. Treaties? What treaties? We're the U.S. government. We don't abide by any treaties. Also on July 20th, 1944, German officer plots to kill Adolf Hitler and staged a coup. Colonel Klaus von Stauffenberg left a briefcase concealing a bomb at Hitler's feet during a meeting. The bomb killed 4 people, but a table leg shielded Hitler. Also on July 20th, 1997, Honduras, announcement of more mass graves of leftists found in military sites by the U.S.-backed government. Lastly, on July 20th, 2001, Carlo Gallini, a 23-year-old Italian activist and anarchist, dies during a demonstration against the G8 summit in Genoa. Gallini was killed in a clash between protesters and Italian military police, who shot him and then ran over his body with a jeep. This Week in Radical History is produced at the Glee Glee Studios. Welcome to two groups airing my little ditty, RadicalRadio.org and KLGR 95.3 FM in Boulder. And thanks to all those emails about my show. Got any comments about this? Too long, too short, just right? Please consider emailing me at themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. That's it for this week in Radical History. A reminder what anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman once said, if voting ever really changed anything, they would have made it illegal. And until next week, as always, I'm yours in the struggle, Mike Cannon.
Give these people a voting day every year so that they'll have the illusion of meaningless choice. Meaningless choice that we go like slaves and say, God, I voted.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next. This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is John Roberts. This morning's entire edition of This Week in Palestine consists of our interview with anthropologist, author, activist, and co-founder of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, Jeff Halper. Jeff discusses his latest book, War Against the People, Israel, the Palestinians, and Global Pacification, which is a frightening examination of the Israeli weapons and security development industry. Good morning, Jeff, and welcome to This Week in Palestine. It's wonderful to have you back in the Boston area.
Good to be here again in Boston.
It's always fun. You've written a book, War Against the People, about the burgeoning Israeli weapons and security technology industry. You explore Israel's role in creating the technology for what we call global pacification. What led you to focus on this particular issue, and what role does it play in the in the Israeli occupation strategy?
Well, you know, as an activist for many years, I've been the head of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions for 20 years, but active in Palestine for more than 40 years. You know, the question always kind of nagged at the back of my mind, how does Israel get away with this? You know, we're 60, 70 years past the colonial era. The occupation has been lasting now for 50 years. It's in violation of international law, human rights conventions, in defiance of dozens of UN resolutions, even in defiance of American foreign policy, which is for a two-state solution, and to the degree that the United States is Israel's patron, you would think that would count for something. It's a brutal occupation. So, you see it on TV all the time, there's books, and I don't think there's been a more documented conflict in history. It's happening in the Holy Land, no less, so you'd think that would arouse certain opposition of synagogues and mosques and churches. And it's on the southern border of Europe. This isn't happening in the far-off jungles of the Congo or Vietnam or Colombia. This is on the Mediterranean. And with all of that, Israel gets away with it. And not only gets away with it, but in fact, Israel's international status improves all the time. Not necessarily among the people. I think there's been a change in public opinion, but certainly among governments. Israel, a couple of years ago, was elected to the OECD, which is the club of the most advanced economies in the world. To be elected, you have to be elected unanimously. So here are the most advanced economies of the world, including the United States. But you would assume then these are the most educated populations and the countries that are most liberal, that give lip service at least to human rights. You know about Norway, Ireland, Sweden. And here they unanimously elect Israel to their club, despite the fact that the guidelines of the OECD require a country to conform to human rights. So the question is, why? What's going on here? And the usual explanations that we hear, AIPAC, you know, the Israeli lobby in Washington, which is powerful, but it's only in the United States. It doesn't run the rest of the world. And it doesn't run the American government either. Christian fundamentalists, Christian Zionists that support Israel, like Sarah Palin or Pat Robertson, well, they also have clout here, but they don't have clout in most other parts of the world that do support Israel. Guilt over the Holocaust might work in Germany. I don't think that motivates the United States in particular. So all those explanations didn't really explain the global phenomenon of why Israel gets the international support it gets. And, of course, the big elephant in the room, the big reason is its military security and police prowess. In other words, what I'm arguing is that Israel takes what it learned in the occupation on the Palestinians, you know, the weapons that it develops in controlling a population, the security systems it develops, the surveillance systems with more than 600 checkpoints, with thousands of Palestinians going through, the matrix of control, this model of control, permanent control over the occupied territory that Israel has globalized, this has become its main export. And so, in a sense, you might say the occupation, how to control people, which is, of course, of tremendous use to elites all over the world, from the United States and its police forces and so on, and army, down to, you know, the worst warlord in Africa, like Equatorial Guinea, where Israel's very involved. All elites and all governments need these kinds of technologies. And so Israel, I think there's a quid pro quo here, where Israel delivers the means of control, and in return, you know, it's allowed to continue its occupation. That's kind of in a nutshell what I'm arguing.
What role does it play in the occupation? You talk in the book about how Palestine is a kind of a laboratory.
That's right.
Expand on that.
Well, you know, warfare has changed. And you don't have any more, really, war in the conventional sense. Armies fighting armies, countries fighting countries, tanks, fighter airplanes, battleships. That kind of war is really gone. And the new form of warfare is what generals call war amongst the people. In other words, a counterinsurgency, asymmetrical warfare, urban warfare, hybrid warfare, what we see today, what the United States is fighting, like five of those kinds of wars in Somalia, North Africa, Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, fighting the Mexican drug cartels in Mexico and so on. So these are the new forms of warfare. They're called wars amongst the people. I put it within the capitalist framework. And there's a reason why each country needs Israeli security prowess and works with Israel. But overall, there's the broader issue of world capitalism, which is a system we live in, which really runs the entire world, and is becoming more and more repressive. As resources become scarcer, as more and more people are excluded from the capitalist system, as the whole flow of capital is disrupted by resistance. You have resistance abroad, you have resistance here in the United States, everything from Ferguson to Occupy Wall Street and so on. So as the income disparities get huge, and you have the 1%, 99%, literally, and you have more unrest and more resistance because people don't get excluded voluntarily, the whole capitalist system led by the United States has to become more repressive. And as it becomes more repressive, these are where you get wars against the people, wars amongst the people emerging. And I call them wars against the people. That's where the title of my book comes from, because that's really what they are. They're not wars amongst the people, in which the people just happen to be there, but they're against the people, in order to enforce the rule and the hegemony of global capitalism. Now, the United States isn't really geared towards that kind of war. And there's a whole huge internal contradiction here that's interesting. The Pentagon's arsenal is really geared toward interstate warfare. The Pentagon is really geared towards fighting the Soviet Union, not towards these wars amongst the people. Partly because the United States doesn't have much experience in that, You had Vietnam. It didn't do too well. And, you know, in these wars, and then that led to a period of 20 years of what was called the Vietnam complex, where the United States didn't want to get involved at all because it doesn't fight these wars very well. It doesn't have the appropriate weapons. F-16s, F-35s aren't very effective against the people. But in addition to that, wars against the people require smaller arms. It's close combat, and you need tear gas. You need different kinds of gases. You need smaller arms. You need drones rather than F-16s. You need a smaller armored personnel carriers. They can get into alleyways, not tanks, for example. And so the United States doesn't have the appropriate weaponry, and partly that's because, I think, its military is actually geared to create jobs. And so, you need to build, the F-35, for example, is this $1 trillion cutting-edge stealth jet bomber. That's useless. And Robert Gates, when he was the Secretary of Defense, tried to cancel it because it was too expensive and it's not appropriate for wars amongst the people. But he couldn't because it was too far down the pipeline and there's too many jobs. So what happens is if you're making small arms that are appropriate to war against the people, they don't generate many jobs. And so there's not, so you don't want to get into those wars and you don't have the weapons for them. But at the same time, the weapons that you do have that do generate jobs, the Pentagon has $1 trillion a year budget, are not the types of weapons that are appropriate for the types of wars being fought. So as the United States gets dragged into these wars, because essentially it has to more and more control and repress resistance to world capitalism, including at home, where you have the militarization of the police. So you've got to try to find weaponry that's relevant to the police as well. Israel becomes a go-to place. That's a niche for Israel because Israel, with the occupation, has been fighting a war against the people, the Palestinians, for 100 years now. So Israel has those weapons and those techniques and those security systems and the experience that the United States doesn't have, and a lot of other global powers, and so I take that into account as well, and I think that that's where, in a sense, the occupation becomes in microcosm what's happening globally between the global North and the global South, and in a sense, the global North, led by the United States, is engaged more and more in a world occupation so that Israel is able to convince the United States and other countries that it's really indispensable in developing all kinds of techniques and weaponry for the pursuit of that global domination and repression.
Well, does this help explain Gaza? That is to say, people trying to understand why you would bomb Gaza the way and use the kind of weaponry against Gaza in retaliation to them shooting, some minor rockets,
That's right, exactly. And that's right. You can't explain the attack on Gaza. Any of the attacks, but the last one in 2014... in military terms, the military threat posed by those Qassam rockets to Israel, they were a nuisance, but they certainly didn't pose any existential threat or major threat. They were very localized. You can't explain the massive disproportional attack on Gaza by those rockets. Something else had to be going on. And I think that something else was two things. One was Israel was saying to the Palestinians, and they were a little bit contradictory things. Because on the one hand, Israel's saying to the Hamas, especially, but to the Palestinians, because don't forget the attack on Gaza is preceded by a military operation in the West Bank called Operation Brothers Keeper. The message was zero tolerance. You know, it's over. No more negotiations. No more two states. No more Palestinian rights. You know, we are asserting our control over the entire country. No resistance, period. You're being imprisoned. That was one message. But the other was the use, again, of Gaza, like the West Bank, as a laboratory for perfecting and developing weapons. I have in my book a whole list of weapons that were used for the first time in Gaza. One of them being, for example, the Hermes drone, a new Israeli drone, the Hermes 900. It was even rushed out of production, wasn't even being tested in particular. And then Gaza was literally the testing grounds of that drone and a lot of other kinds of weapons and tactics, not just weapons themselves. So, you know, it's contradictory because on the one hand, I argue that the occupied territory is a laboratory, and therefore, because it's a highly competitive industry, you know, the military, security, and police, if you take those three elements together, because today they're really one package, constitute a $2.5 trillion a year industry. I mean, Israel obviously is one player; it's not the major player, but nevertheless, it's a huge industry to be involved in. And what gives Israel an edge is both that it's plugged into what the new form of warfare is in the world, which is war amongst the people, war against the people. And it's got a laboratory, which is Gaza, the West Bank, and then sometimes southern Lebanon, in other places where it can actually experiment on. So if you see the websites of the Israeli weapons companies that are selling these things, they say combat proven, field tested in Gaza, you see.
Right.
So there's a direct relationship. So what I'm saying is that on the one hand, Israel needs that laboratory. So it has an interest in maintaining a manageable level of conflict with the Palestinians that justifies, experimenting with these things. On the other hand, I think it's also trying to end the occupation from the point of view of ending Palestinian resistance and simply incorporating, not Gaza, but incorporating the West Bank into Israel. So, you know, it shows, I think, that there isn't one mind. This isn't a conspiracy. This isn't like a one-to-one correlation. You know, it's kind of an approach, let's say. I mean, Israel certainly knows it has an occupation. It has a laboratory. But at the same time, that contradicts other interests, especially, let's say, of the settlers and of other right-wing Israelis of saying, well, let's take over the whole country. We don't want it to be a laboratory. We want it to be the land of Israel. So you have opposing forces, even within the right wing of Israel, that view the occupation in different ways. But certainly I would argue that Israel sees, in general, Israel sees the occupation as a laboratory.
We take great pride in this country in saying that we've addressed or are addressing the kind of Jim Crow segregated society that we've had in our past, and we keep talking about applying human rights standards to other countries that want to relate to us or whatever, and yet we support Israel, which has a de facto segregated society and a de jure. That is a segregated apartheid society by law. And yet the United States, as you point out earlier, the United States sort of just sets aside all those standards.
Uh-huh.
And Is this part of the reason that the United States is somehow dependent on Israel for this kind of weaponry or this kind of technology? Does this explain that? Or partially explain?
Well, it partially explains it. One of the expressions of all of this is Israel's importance in airport security in the United States, and in training the American police. So, and in, of course, border controls, where Israel's, you know, the wall that Bush and Trump and everybody want to build with Mexico would be, I mean, Mexico might pay for it, but it's an Israeli. Elbit and Boeing are joining forces and building it. So as, you know, of course, with 9/11 and with the this whole move towards homeland security and mixing domestic concerns like crime, you think about the militarized language, war on crime, war on drugs and so on, the militarization of the police, and this whole concern about terrorism and so on, that's become a very fertile ground for Israel. And what the United States is finding, I think, is that the democratic protections that people are supposed to be given get in the way. And Israel's trying to help the United States deal with that, because it has this reputation of being super effective in terms of terrorism, and that's what gives Israel that legitimacy, that authority in this realm. The United States is being transformed into what Israel is, which is a security state. It's moving from being a democracy to being a security state in which security trumps everything. And you see it today, for example, in this fight between the FBI and Apple over the cell phone.
Right.
You know, I think the vast majority of Americans will side with the FBI. In other words, side with the idea of security that trumps everything over privacy and democratic protections and so on. That's the move towards a security state. Now, there are things within... Now, the United States wants to become that, or at least the ruling classes certainly do. The problem is that you do have certain protections in the United States. Take one example, ethnic profiling, or racial profiling. That's supposed to be illegal. Now, we know, certainly from Ferguson and from a lot of other cases, that in fact the police kind of do that, but they're not supposed to. And airports aren't supposed to. What happens is you put a lot of emphasis on hardware, on technology to detect, let's say in airports, what people are bringing through, because you can't pull out black people or Arabs or people you suspect, because that's a kind of racial profiling that's illegal in the United States. Well, Israel's whole system is based on that.
Right.
You see, Israel, in fact, if you go to Ben-Gurion Airport, there isn't a tremendous amount of technology. It's all based on interactions. And if you go to the kids, the security people, the young people, in the line before you get to the counter, everybody complains about the dumb questions they ask. You know, what are the names of your kids? You know, what's your birthday? These innocuous kind of dumb questions, but in fact, they can tell from your reactions if you're getting nervous. And, of course, they target immediately. You know, you have a certain visa in your passport from an Arab country, or you look Arab, or you have an Arab name, or whatever. I mean, immediately you're taken out. So they do things that you couldn't do in the States. So what's happening is that, in a sense, police forces and security forces here and conservative politicians are urging that kind of these practices on the United States. You know, because these are necessary, they would argue, for a security state. Israel now, well, who knows more about security than Israel? This is what Israel does, so we should be doing it. So in fact, these practices trickle in, and they begin to really undermine the democratic protections that the citizens have here. So it's a good example of how Israel encourages, you know, this kind of a movement. I ask, you know, Israel trains American police forces. It has all kinds of programs and comes here to train police, and American police go there. And, you know, the question is why? What is Israel training them in? Well, you got to train the LAPD, which is the most brutal police force in the country that invented SWAT teams. What is Israel going to teach
them? Well, even Cambridge sent police.
They all send police. Sure. What do they learn? And one of the things that they're learning, again, not that they're learning. I don't know how much they actually learn. But it's a junket, first of all. It's a nice trip, and you know everybody likes to play with guns, and you get to see how the Israelis deal with terrorists and all that. But beyond that, I think, you know, the police are militarized. They have a militarized mindset. They want to be more macho and more armed and to have more authorities. So, in a sense, I think what happens is that being in Israel. You know, you can go back to your superiors or to the mayor or to the city council or the state legislature, whatever, and you can say, Israel recommends that we restructure our department this way. Israel recommends that we develop these kinds of arms. Israel recommends that we engage more in racial profiling or that we change our procedures for firing. And in a sense, it's what they want to do anyway. It isn't that Israel really invented that. They want to do it anyway, but Israel gives them that legitimacy. Who's going to argue with Israel in terms of terrorism, you see? So in a sense, it's very useful in terms of advancing an agenda that anyway you want to advance, but now you can do it under the guise of an Israeli recommendation. It's very subtle in many ways that Israel works here.
You talk about how in Palestine's Israel issue is becoming less an occupation than a warehousing.
That's right.
We in the United States know about warehousing. We know how to warehouse prisoners a very large degree. And you talk about how this security state really is very helpful to nations that want to warehouse segments of their population, and there certainly are countries all over the world engaged in that. Would you talk a little bit about how Israel plays, how they play that warehouse card?
Well, you know, like I said before, war amongst the people, war against the people, brings together the military and homeland security and local policing. These things that used to be fairly distinct are today coming together more and more. You have the military is being policified as you go out to nation change and regime build and so on, protect resources, the police at home are being militarized, which is clear. So these things begin to come together. So together, war used to be that you'd fight a war and then you'd win, and then, you know, you dictate some terms and go home. But now we're talking about permanent repression. This is a never-ending battle, and in fact, you know, the policing part of it, including prisons, and who you're imprisoning and how you or who are you even repressing? It doesn't always get to prisons. I mean, repressing black people and the poor people, black people and so on, is an everyday thing. You know, dismantling Occupy Wall Street was a kind of a permanent thing. So that the side of warfare, the war against the people that's almost invisible, is this whole policing, imprisoning, disciplining aspect. If you think about it, wars are very dramatic. They're events. They have names. The war in Iraq, the Six-Day War, the Vietnam War, the Civil War. I mean, they have names, they have dates, they have beginnings, they have ends, and so on. Whereas we're talking here, in terms of war against the people, about what's called the everyday war. You know, that if war is policing in the world, you're trying to keep the world safe for capitalism, flows of capitalism and domination and so on, and ending resistance, then at home, policing is a form of war, a form of class war. Especially, again, if you get into this issue of the 1% and 99%, and more people are being, including young middle-class people, like in the Occupy movement, that are being excluded from the system more and more. So it's this everyday war of policing and security and repression that becomes really the most important form of war. But it's fairly invisible. Partly because, you know, the police are just around. Their weapons are very unsexy. You know, they're not weapons that, police cars and you get police vans. They're not like F-16s or tanks, you know. And they're ubiquitous. They're just in the woodwork. They're just around. And you can get a cop on your tail, your red light. You can ask the cop for directions. And so the repression becomes more invisible, you see. And so warehousing is partly, you know, where you're warehousing prisoners. That's what the word refers to explicitly. But you can also warehouse populations. So I talk about warehousing the Palestinians, and that Israel is turning the whole occupied territory into a mass prison where their movement is being controlled, their rights are controlled, the food they can use is controlled, everything is controlled.
The roads they can use.
The roads, everything. It's like being in a prison. But you can expand that further. You can talk about the continent of Africa becoming warehoused from the point of view that these are people excluded from the capitalist system, but who aren't allowed to resist as their resources are being taken and they're being impoverished. So warehousing, is a very useful, and so it applies to prisoners in this country, but I think it can be expanded in a wider sense to ghettos and to communities of poor people and reservations for Native Americans,
right.
and more and more to the 99%. That's in the process of being warehoused. And that's all a part, again, of the war against the people. And again, you know, that Israel's certainly not the only actor in this. I'm not saying that. But Israel becomes very useful, again, because it's very proactive and it has those kinds of weapons and tactics. So I land last week in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm taken to Georgia State University. Okay, to give a talk. I'm looking out the window at the building, and right next door is called the Gilley Center, G-I-L-E-E, if you look it up on the Internet, the Georgia International Law Exchange Center. So it turns out that there's a huge center on the campus of Georgia State University run by Israelis, and run by very pro-Zionist Israeli money. It's the Marcus Foundation. This guy Marcus runs Home Depot. The Home Depot, you know, provides the funding, but it's filled with Israeli instructors. And if you go into the website, all the pictures are these American law enforcement officers from all over the United States being brought to Israel for training. And then Israelis coming here for training, not only, but largely through this Gilley Center in Georgia. So the students, for example, have tried to lock onto that as a BDS target.
Mm-hmm.
On our campus is an Israeli repression institute. They can't get any information. It's a black hole. They can't get the syllabi. They can't get the curriculums. They don't know who's teaching there. They don't know who's studying there. On their campus, in a building, in a university-connected program, they don't know anything about it. So, you know, that's just one example of the degree to which Israel is is proactively penetrating into the most sensitive parts of American internal sovereignty, your policing and your communities and your borders and your prisons. So that's where, you know, you can take this idea of warehousing and expand it out into the community where, you know, whatever people threaten the hegemony of capitalism and its workings can be warehoused by the police using these kinds of tactics and so on, which is a form of imprisonment.
Well, it comes down to how do you control people?
That's right.
And Israel's creating the mechanisms to increasingly be able to control people. Israel has a robust economy. It's developing this security weapons industry, and yet the United States pours more money into Israel than any other nation on earth. Some $3 billion a year, and it's beyond that now.
No, it's beyond that.
And now Obama's talking about giving more money to Netanyahu because Netanyahu's nose is out of joint or something. Anyway,
that's right. He signed a bill giving Israel $40 billion in new arms over the next 10 years.
Right. So what's going on there? Why this economic subsidy to this large degree? What's going on between these two countries with that kind of money flowing back and forth?
Well, again, on one level, it's a subsidy of the American defense contractors. Not just the Pentagon, of course, but Boeing and Lockheed and Northrop Grumman and a million different local manufacturers. Because of the $40 billion, let's see, over a 10-year period, 70% has to be spent in the United States. So it's not that Israel gets $40 billion to go buy French arms. It's really money doesn't even change hands. It's really a subsidy for the American defense industry. Israel also, of course, tests American weapons. I mean, Israel's getting delivery of a squadron of F-35s before the American Air Force does, because it's a great testing grounds for American weaponry. But in addition to that, you know, Israel is seen, again, as a very useful ally, a very useful agent for pursuing this war against the people in ways that the United States can't or won't or whatever. So unlike other countries, only 70% of that $40 billion has to be spent in the U.S. 30% Israel can take for its own development of its own defense industry. Because, you know, Israel, the United States has an interest in Israel developing these products that then get reintegrated. And don't forget the technological developments. It isn't just weapons. But it's these technologies of control. So Israel's the world leader in airport security. Yeah, you got 600 checkpoints that Palestinians go through. And so those kinds of high-tech, you know, Israel's a high-tech leader because its high-tech is connected to the military and surveillance and so on. Well, those technologies that Israel develops, again, get fed back into the American military and commercial technologies. So it's an investment. That 30% is an investment that comes back to the United States. And it's a joint development of projects and programs and so on. But at the same, that leaks into other areas. I mean, you know, Israel's the world's leader in the applications of nanotechnology to military. But nanotechnology has tremendous other applications in the biomedical field, for example, in energy, so that it also, in a way, if you look at it that way, the United States is sort of investing in a high-tech industry in Israel that really flows back into the United States in very, you know, and spills out into other areas. And at the same time, of course, Israel has privileged access to American military technology. So it's basically expanding the military and wider technologies of the United States over to Israel. Intel, for example, and we all have Intel in our computers, is really a military company. I mean, the basis of all these technologies is the military. They have the billions of dollars. So they develop technologies for their use that and bring them to a point where then commercial companies can kick in and use them. You know, the Internet itself was developed by the Pentagon. Yeah, Intel has three research and developing centers, the Silicon Valley, part of which is Israeli. There's a part of the Silicon Valley, it's called the Humus Valley. So you have a real strong component of Israelis there in California, and Ireland, and Israel. So that the connection between these technologies that eventually spill out into our PCs and the military in Israel are very... So in a sense, I think the United States gets a lot out of it, including, again, those types of weapons and technologies of repression that Israel is very good at developing.
Okay, so if that's the case, and you've painted this portrait of how our defense industries are interrelated, how we're scratching each other's back, how money flows back and forth, supporting jobs in this country, etc. Talk to it in your book. One fascinating point was that you exposed how Israel is becoming a major supporter and supplier of weapons for China, for India, for countries that we could argue at times are our enemies, and that may be a strong word, but here we are concerned about China and what's happening in the South China Sea, et cetera, and this partner of ours is arming them to the teeth.
Exactly.
So
that's right.
How long is this going? How do these partners deal with that?
That's right. I mean, first of all, they're a part of the capitalist system. They're simply rivals in terms of who's going to take over the capitalist system. I mean, China, you know, has a brand of state, and Brazil, the other BRICS countries, India and so on, have a form of state capitalism. It's different from American, but it's still capitalism. And it still needs access to the world's resources and so on. So it's really competition over control, or at least major access to the world economy that we're talking about. You know, Kissinger used to say, our friend Henry, used to say the countries don't have friends, they have interests. And so you see that in terms of who Israel is working with. I mean, Israel, on the one hand, if you ask your member of Congress, why do you support Israel? Uncritically, the way you do, and almost all of them do, the answer is because Israel's our most loyal ally in the Middle East. But actually, if you look at Israel's military, security, police relationships, Israel, it turns out, is number 2, 3, 4 armed supplier to China, which is the major rival of the United States. You're moving a whole 6th fleet into the South Pacific to contain China. So, and of course, it's not just security and military, it's American military technologies. That if you get into war with China, you're going to be fighting is American technologies built into Chinese weapons. So, you know, so it's a good example of how there are no friends when you're dealing with arms and all that money and even the whole capitalist system, you know. But that's really the reality, and that is that Israel does not have all its eggs in the American basket. It's willing to supply all these BRICS countries that are the major rivals of Euro-American hegemony. That's fine with Israel. It doesn't care about Euro-American. It wants its own to pursue its own interests everywhere. It's very strong in all the BRICS countries. And that's a part of it. You know, you have to really understand that, and it's true of capitalism in general. I mean, capitalism certainly isn't contained by the United States. I mean, that's where the in Europe is a concentration of the capitalist decision makers, the ruling classes. But they're not so much loyal to any particular country. They're loyal to their profits. So you can see that with outsourcing and what's happening to the American economy. Israel has that, Israel, I think, sees itself as serving the hegemons. The hegemons are not country-specific. The hegemons are the ruling classes, who has the defense industries, who has the big corporations, who needs their stuff. And from that point of view, you know, I found that tracing Israel's involvement in the world's arms industry, because, you know, it's a small country. It has to scramble. It can't be too choosy. And so it can't be like the United States with a huge budget. And the United States can say, we're not going to do business with China. Okay. Israel can't do that.
Do you think the United States can still blow the whistle on Israel? I mean, we keep hearing this that,
you're right.
I'm wondering, do you think Israel's, with its contrast with China and India, as you say,
Israel's trying to be careful a little bit. Israel pulls back when it has to. There was, in fact, I talk about it in my book, in 2003, Richard Perle, who was one of the Jewish neocons, with Wolfowitz and all these other guys, Richard Perle was an assistant secretary of defense. Super pro-Israel, Jewish, neocon. But it got to a point with Israel's passing American military technology to China, especially through the Falcon. Israel was selling these Falcon surveillance planes to China, where Richard Perle, a Jewish neocon, pro-Israel, threatened Israel that the United States would cut off diplomatic relations with it if it didn't stop the Falcon deal with China. So it's gotten to a point where even in the Bush administration, they were talking about maybe cutting relations with Israel. I mean, there are red lines.
Yeah.
And Israel pulled back. They canceled the Falcon deal, which was a big thing for Israel. I think until today, the guy that was the director general of the Israeli Ministry of Defense can't come to the United States. There is that a certain sensitivity. But I think Israel, knows how to play the game, and it pulls back at certain times. It pushes the envelope, certainly.
Yeah.
And then it relies on the fact that members of Congress support it. It doesn't really care about the administration.
No,
it has congressional
right.
support.
We saw that this past few months.
And that's what gives it much more leeway than it would have if it was simply up to the administration.
Yeah. Well, we've run out of time. I think we'll have to leave it there, unfortunately. Jeff Halper's book is War Against the People, Israel, the Palestinians, and Global Pacification. It is published by Pluto Press. Thanks, Jeff, and thanks.
Thanks for having me on.
All your good work and good luck with the book.
Okay, thank you much.
That was anthropologist and activist Jeff Halper, co-founder of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. What does it say about a country when the consequences of being late for a job interview at the job centre are greater than illegally invading a country and killing millions of innocent people? The Iraq War criminals, are they also the murderers of MOD weapons inspector Dr. David Kelly? No justice, even with Chilcot, and also a massive blast in Baghdad kills 250 innocent people to remind us what a disaster the invasion of Iraq really was and how the United Nations was right not to give Britain and America a resolution to start the war. Also, yesterday evening in Dallas, snipers kill 5 police officers and injure 6 more at an otherwise peaceful Black People Matter rally. Black Lives Matter, sorry. Plus, an exclusive interview with one of the most important intelligence insiders in the run-up to the illegal invasion of Iraq. That's Susan Lindauer. She suffered a year in jail to keep her out of the way and was threatened with being drugged into a permanent zombie just for telling the truth. And it was Colin Powell who was behind it. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspot. We'll have some clips from Susan Lindauer tonight, but you can hear the full interview on our sister show Dialect, which is back at noon every Tuesday here on BCFM 93.2. Well, we'll be talking a lot about Chilcot, Martin, but let's start with last night's horrendous attack over in Dallas, Texas. Of course, the venue in 1963 for the assassination of the US President John F. Kennedy.
Indeed. Obviously, it's very hard at this immediately after the event to follow all the detail of it. I think the fear has to be that this is part of a Gladio-style psychological warfare strategy in the US, similar to what was NATO carried out in Italy in the 1970s and 1980s, where social division is encouraged through the encouragement of left and right wing violence, because of in order to allow the state to have more powers of control and intimidation. I'm not saying that is what's happened, but The use of snipers during mass demonstrations is very suspicious, because we saw that in Kiev, in the Maidan Square. We saw it in Tunisia. We've seen it in Venezuela. We've seen it in Egypt as part of a strategy of tension. And of course, you very rarely saw such things taking place in Northern Ireland over the years, because the IRA realised that you can't use snipers while you've got a mass demonstration on.
Just looking at the news reports on this, we've had a so-called confession, which has been delivered to the police by one of these snipers. And there were certainly at least two, because we heard there were bullets were coming from different directions. Mm. So as people, the police officers and members of the demonstration tried to hide behind one sort of barrier, then they opened fire from a different direction. So we know that there were at least two snipers. And the only thing what bothers me is we've got a confession from the police, but then the police blew up the guy that had made the confession. I mean, this isn't really justice. This almost seems like rolling things out through the press rather than actually going to court about events.
Well, if we go back to what happened in Maidan Square in Kiev, I think the evidence is overwhelming now that the snipers were actually linked to the new regime. They were Pravi sector snipers who had been trained at the Warsaw Police Academy by NATO special forces, possibly including the British. They then shot both police officers and demonstrators in order to create chaos. We saw similar things happen in Thailand during the Red Shirts uprising against the regime there. And it's part of a particularly NATO intelligence services Psy war strategy. You have mass demonstrations, people in those demonstrations open fire on the police, this is what happened in Syria, and then the police overreact by opening fire on the demonstrators. Thus you set off a cycle of violence which then allows you to either overthrow the regime that's in power or to bring in a police state by the back door. Now I'm not saying that is what's happened in Dallas, we haven't got enough detail yet, but we certainly know that that's the sort of thing that's been going on. A lot of the incidents in the United States, to my mind, are fabricated false flag incidents, and this may well be another one.
This guy, of course, who's been blown up by the police, was actually only a suspect, so we don't really have hard evidence that he was one of the shooters.
Well, what you do in these things is you get somebody who's slightly unhinged, you persuade them to do something crazy, then you kill them so that they can never be put on trial, and who put them up to it to come out, and you create an atmosphere of chaos and tension. So what happened in Italy was the far right and the far left were both infiltrated by the intelligence services, and their violence was being used in order to steer the state in a certain direction, and they had no qualms about killing civilian police officers as part of the strategy of tension. And this has all been uncovered by police investigations in Italy, by the judiciary over there. It's not disputable, and it's the sort of thing that Labour MPs ought to know about, but they don't. And so when things like this happen, everybody throws up their arms in horror and goes, gosh, isn't this terrible? You know, one side of the aisle is saying the police are killing black people, isn't it awful? The other side is saying, look, police officers are being shot, isn't it awful? And the point is that the whole thing is quite possibly being orchestrated. Well, I'm not sure that it's being orchestrated. We haven't got enough information yet. But in other circumstances, these kind of incidents are being orchestrated, and they've been orchestrating them for decades now.
Well, what we're hearing at the moment from WFAA in Dallas is that 14 people in total were shot. Two were civilians. The police department identified the suspect as Micah X. Johnson of Mesquite, which is just on the east side of Dallas. I know that because I've looked quite a lot at the JFK assassination, and it was in Mesquite where James Files stayed, who certainly looks like the guy that was the main shooter of JFK back in those times. And you can hear the excerpts from interviews with James Files, the hitman for the mafia, who were from Chicago, who came down to kill John F. Kennedy, essentially with the backup of the FBI, the CIA, and Lyndon Johnson, the vice president. That's certainly the way it looks in our investigations, and we've done a whole investigation into this exactly 50 years after that on this show a few years ago. But Martin, there's more and more people being reported as being shot all the time, and also civilians being shot, so this doesn't look as if it's something which has just been aimed at the police.
Well, as I say, what happened in the Maidan Square, which makes it very suspicious, is both police officers and demonstrators were being shot from the same from the same location, which was under the control of Pravi Sector. What we saw happening in Syria is you've got peaceful demonstrations against the regime, and then jihadi terrorists opening fire on the police, and then the police opening fire on demonstrators and creating bloodshed. Now, these kind of situations are frequently manipulated. Mass demonstrations plus snipers, as I said, you very rarely saw that in Northern Ireland because the IRA were very careful
to
avoid
it. What the media are saying is the suspect said he wanted to kill white people. Well, that isn't actually from his own mouth, and this has been produced as a fact, whereas actually it's only an allegation that's coming from the police.
Well, when somebody who's dead apparently makes an inflammatory statement like that, my alarm bells start ringing. What sense does it make to make such a statement? And, of course, if it was a lone nutcase doing that, OK, but we've got more than one sniper. We've already established that. So there's certainly an organisation behind this. The question is, whose organisation? What organisation? And most of the so-called jihadi terrorists in the United States have been people set up by the FBI. Most of the far-right terrorists have also been people set up by the FBI. And no doubt most of these kind of what you might call pseudo-Black Panther terrorists are also being set up by the FBI. And they've got a track record of doing this going back to the 1960s and COINTELPRO, which everybody who reads anything knows is what they were getting up to. But no doubt there will be the usual idiots running around in the mainstream media painting broad-brush cultural criticisms of this, that and the other going on, the police violence,
what you seem to be saying is that there's an attempt to kind of almost get a race war going in the United States between poor black people and poor white people. What would be the purpose of something like that?
So that the rich white people at the top of the pile can carry on raking in their dough. It's as simple as that, really. It's fundamental. I mean, one of the main motives behind the 9/11 attacks looks like an insurance fraud by those who had just bought the World Trade Center had been privatized 6 weeks before, and the consortium that bought it got a massive payout when the buildings so mysteriously came down in one go through a terrorist attack, which they just happened to have insured themselves against, which put a lot of money in their pockets.
The biennial NATO summit, once every 2 years this happens. It was in Newport, I think, wasn't it, a couple of years ago?
Yeah.
It's just opened in Poland. The US says it will deploy 1,000 extra troops to Poland on the same day that Obama has given a speech about this attack over in Dallas.
Well, I just cannot see the point. I mean, I know what they're trying to do. They're trying to intimidate the Russians and prevent the Western Europeans, and that includes the East Europeans, from having a sensible, constructive economic relationship with the Russian Federation. That's what this is about. They want the West Europeans, including Eastern Europe, to sign up to the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, and they want to end all economic linkages, particularly between Germany and the Russian Federation. Now, that doesn't make any sense at all from the point of view of German industry and the future of the German economy, but it makes absolute sense if you're sitting in Washington or in London. And that's, of course, what this is all about. It's provoking conflict in order to control the outcome.
I mean, back in 1990, with the fall of the Berlin Wall, something was signed called the 2+4 agreement between the Russian Federation, as it was at the time, Russia, effectively, and NATO. And as part of that agreement, they said that there would be no NATO troops be allowed into East Germany, only German troops. And yet that agreement has been just simply torn up. They've now got NATO troops, including all sorts of different forces personnel in East Germany. So what would you say?
And not only in East Germany, in Poland and the Baltic states as well, as we've just pointed out.
That's right. So there does seem to have been a roll forward of NATO right up to the border of Russia, including this missile defence screen, which has now been installed in Romania and is now being built in Poland, right on the Russian doorstep. Now, this is getting us very close to the whole situation which happened in 1962 with the Cuban Missile Crisis, where the Russians objected to having these possible nuclear weapons right on their doorstep. Well, American nuclear weapons.
Yeah, in Turkey.
Thousands and thousands and thousands of miles away from America, right next to Russia.
Yeah. I think the only thing that's keeping the lid on all of this is that the Russian general staff are very rational and have prepared very thoroughly for this situation. There is no way in any shape or form that they are going to win a fight against the Russian armed forces on Russian territory. And the Russians have no intention of leaving their territory. So all they've got to do is sit tight. And even these missile defence were very provocative, because the purpose of having these missile defences in Romania and elsewhere would be to knock out Russian leadership with a first strike, which prevents a second strike from taking place. So they're not defensive at all, they're offensive. But the Russians are pretty calm about this, because mutually assured destruction hasn't disappeared. They've got submarines out there, which, just as we have, which can incinerate Britain and the United States if Russia is attacked. So the good news is that the Russian general staff are well prepared and are very sensible about the situation. They're very annoyed at being provoked, but they're not going to be provoked. So a lot of this is silly. Steinmeier, the German foreign minister, has made exactly this point. He's at the summit, and he's from inside the NATO summit saying, look, this is silly. We can't go around kicking sand in the Russians' eyes. It's pointless.
Manfred Petrich was saying last week, Martin, that actually Europe is a major target for nuclear strikes by the Russians now, because of all the nuclear weapons which the Americans have in Europe. And he was also saying that the whole purpose of NATO now has nothing to do with defence, but it's in order to stop Germany and Russia making any alliances at all.
Well, that's exactly right. And that's why it probably won't come to an all-out war, because what the purpose of all of this is to prevent friendly relations between the Russian Federation and Germany in particular. And, of course, that has been achieved. And the Russian economy is the eighth largest in the world, and we are our policy, as we speak, is to bankrupt the Russian economy. That's the policy of our government. It's also the policy of some members of the Labour Party, good grief to say. It's absolutely bonkers. If we were to bankrupt the Russian economy, as in 1998 the Russian economy was bankrupted, that led to the collapse of long-term capital management in Wall Street and nearly brought on the 2008 crash 10 years early. So if we were to be successful in crashing the Russian economy, we're not being successful, because they've got other options and they're taking them. But were we to be successful in that lunatic goal, we would just be dragging ourselves down into the abyss, because Russia would default on its debts, which would crash Deutsche Bank. Deutsche Bank's going to crash anyway, because it's on the ropes. It's the most exposed bank for derivatives in the whole world. I think all of the insiders in the markets are looking at it, and I'm afraid all of this saber rattling, and of course the NATO exercise in the Baltics has been called flashing saber, just so that the Russians get the message: we're flashing our sabres at you. All of this stuff is extremely dangerous for the financial markets. Absolutely bonkers, but here we are.
Now, it's air show weekend, isn't it? We've got the Farnborough Air Show, and I think it's the Air Tattoo at Fairford 2. I noticed a Royal Puff piece on the BBC with some BBC reporter, some young chap, stood next to one of these new F-35 fighters, which are called the Joint Strike Fighter. No mention of the fact that this Joint Strike Fighter is plagued by design flaws and cost overruns. These things are extremely expensive. Martin, they cost £70 million each. And yet the problem is it only flies in good weather. Computers that run it lack the software they need for combat. No one can say for certain when the planes will actually work as advertised. There's some key problems include the fuel tank design, software delays, no protection from lightning strikes, problem carrying out attacks at certain angles, display issues in the computer rig pilot's helmet, and the unreliable ejector seats, amongst other things. Also, the cracks have been found in the wings of these things, and they cost £70 million each.
Well, the military-industrial complex in the West is not designed to produce effective military kit. It's a great big machine for spending money for the benefit of the corporations that supply the military. And so this is why you've got to have a Russian threat and a Chinese threat, because without a Russian threat and a Chinese threat, there'd be no reason to spend good money after bad producing this kind of third-rate kit. And incidentally, if it did come to conflict, I suspect that the nationalised Russian defence industry will show what it's worth, because they every ruble they spend is very carefully spent, and as we've seen in Syria, the West has been rather shocked by the efficiency of their kit, and that's because nobody makes a private profit on the production of that kit. When the Russian government decides to buy a piece of kit, an aircraft or any other piece of kit, it thinks very carefully about what it wants to spend, because there's no private profit to be made on spending it. So it really is a government decision, and that should be the same. That should be true in the West, but it isn't. In actual fact, jobs in Bristol, for example, at Rolls Royce, depend upon spending the money. So you spend the money because you want the jobs and you want to make the profit, and it's not really about whether you even need the kit.
Well, maybe
you don't need the kit.
Maybe Rolls Royce should be making the engines for this thing, because it's not just the media's word we've got to take for it. Last April, the Government Accountability Office in the US, which works for Congress, said the F-35's engine reliability is poor and has a long way to go to meet program goals. Also, they said cost and affordability challenges remain. Now, what's happened is the US government has cancelled a bunch of orders for the F-35, which have been picked up by the British government.
Oh, well, there we are performing our useful role of putting the British taxpayer on the hook for the things that even the American taxpayer doesn't want to buy. Hooray for our independence, eh?
We got a kind of a cheery contribution to Prime Minister's questions this week on the Farnborough Air Show.
Gerald Howarth.
Mr. Speaker, further to my honourable friend from Worcester's question about UKTI, may I remind the Prime Minister that next Monday the greatest air show in the world takes place
at
Farnborough in my constituency, to which all honourable and right honourable members are expected to attend. And may I remind my right honourable friend that last time, 2 years ago, deals worth $201 billion were signed at the Farnborough Air Show. May I therefore prevail on my right honourable friend, who may have just a little bit more time in his hands, to come and open the show on Monday and encourage all other ministers to attend.
Prime Minister!
I think I'm one of the first Prime Ministers in a while to attend the Farnborough Air Show, and I'm very happy to announce that I will be going back there this year, because I think it's very important. We have, I think, the second largest aerospace industry in the world after the United States, and it is a brilliant moment to showcase that industry to the rest of the world and to clinch some important export deals, both in the military and in the civilian space, and I would always do everything I can, whether in this job or in future, to help support British industry in that way.
$201 billion worth of deals, but this isn't really about civil aviation, certainly for Britain, Martin, is it? Almost all of this is military. Even Airbus, of course, is not actually British. It's a joint foreign-owned company, so even, you know, some of the Airbus work that goes on in Britain, is the profits are not actually made here anymore at all.
Well, that's right. And, of course, what we're really talking about here is we are going, or some people in Britain, are going to make money selling aircraft to Saudi Arabia, for example, which will then be used to kill children in Yemen the following week after we've sold the aircraft to them. And, of course, people don't draw any conclusions from this about the fact that we're creating terrorism and ill feeling towards us around the world. Oh, no, surely not. I mean, we've just made $201 billion last year from selling weapons of war to the most repressive regimes on the planet who are our allies, and we're proud of it, and the Prime Minister wants to go along and show his face. Of course, that means that they are basically showing their bloody hands.
The only civilian aviation really that's manufactured in Britain anymore is something called the Britain Norman Islander on the Isle of Wight, a little sort of commuter prop engine plane, which is really the only vestige that's left of Britain's civil air aviation industry.
Well, that's right. I mean, the attempt to present this as an aerospace jamboree, it's a military aircraft jamboree in which we do indeed lead the world. And of course, we talk about this as if it's an industry. All these military aircraft are sold to governments around the world who buy it with taxpayer money. So we're not talking about building a better widget to sell to consumers. We're talking about persuading governments like those of Saudi Arabia, who've got more money than sense, to buy our kit so that we can carry on making money on that kit, so that certain people can make money on the deals. And that's why we have to have war in Yemen, why we have to have war in Ukraine, why we have to have war in Syria, because we like war. War is what makes us money. And that's... whenever the conflict gets ramped up, the shares of Raytheon, Lockheed, and all these others go up, and that's what it's all about. But of course, it's not really very effective from a war fighting point of view. As I pointed out a minute ago, the Russian nationalised defence industry will thrash us if it comes to a straight fight, because we spend an awful lot of money on rubbish.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com. And leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
Now, the Chilcot Report, International Criminal Court, Martin, says it will not investigate Tony Blair, but it might prosecute the soldiers. And it said this before. This is on Sunday the 3rd. Last Sunday, the International Criminal Court made it public that there's no chance that Tony Blair is coming anywhere near the place.
Well, I mean, the Chilcot Report is like a curate's egg. It's good in parts, isn't it? Certain aspects of what have been said in the sort of establishment ease in which the report is written have been revealing in the sense that, you know, they're stating the obvious, really, but at least we've got an official statement of the obvious. Now, underlying all of this, of course, is the fact that this is, there weren't mistakes made. It wasn't a mistake. It was a crime. It was a preconceived, premeditated crime.
Now, Lord Stoddart mentioned this memo from... get around the right way from Blair to Bush in the bombshell document, which you can find online. There's smoking gun emails. I think that's probably one of the headlines to look for, and I'll put it up on our webpage at thisweek.org.uk. In the bombshell document, headed Secret Memorandum for the President, Colin Powell tells Bush that Blair will be with us on military action. It adds that Blair was preparing to act as a spin doctor for George Bush, who is told the UK will follow our lead.
What's been established here is that Blair agreed to go to war with Bush whilst he was trying to tell Parliament that he was looking for a second resolution from the United Nations. In other words, he misled Parliament. And Alex Salmond, I believe, is going to bring forward an impeachment motion in the House of Commons against Blair on that basis, which could, in theory, lead to him being imprisoned, although I don't think there's been an impeachment motion in the House of Commons since the 1800s.
Peter O'Bourne in the Daily Mail has been doing some excellent work on this, and he's explained that there was the Cabinet Secretary of the time, whose name is not, I can't see immediately, oh that's right, Jeremy Hayward, was having these kind of informal meetings, like round a coffee table, which were not minuted, with Tony Blair in order to try and steer the war through.
Well, exactly, we were talking earlier about cabinet government and so on. That's the whole point about cabinet government, is that there are minutes, and they can eventually be read. But if you don't take any minutes in these meetings, then of course the decisions are not really accountable decisions, are they?
Back in 2003, it was the task of Cabinet Secretary Richard, now Lord Wilson, to ensure that the traditional standards of government were maintained, yet he was frozen out by Blair's inner team of cronies. These included the former Daily Mirror journalist Alistair Campbell, ex-diplomat Jonathan Powell, and Angie Hunter, an old childhood friend of the Prime Minister. Well, now, this sounds like a war which was almost cooked up down the pub.
Yes, it was actually cooked up in the United States of America. And what these people did was they were given instructions by the United States of America and they took them. Catherine Gunn, who was the GCHQ whistleblower, was in The Guardian today saying, well, we were sent an email by the National Security Agency in the United States saying, we want you to spy on all members of the United Nations and if you can who are coming to the UN in New York, so that if you can find anything out that might be useful to us in trying to get our war, could you please tell us? And she was actually outraged, saying, well, you know, why are the US National Security Agency giving us instructions to spy illegally on political leaders coming to the UN? And, that's the point at which she blew the whistle and leaked the email. The fact is that the war in Iraq was decided long before 9/11. And 9/11 was actually part of the psychological warfare preparation for the war in Iraq. And I'm afraid even the most radical mainstream Labour politicians still don't get this.
Well, we heard from Admiral Lord West, really from the horse's mouth, from one of the top military people, that this was being cooked up a year before it ever happened, back in the middle of 2002. I was quite amazed, I suppose not so amazed nowadays, to see that the Bilderberg meeting in 2002, which happened in the US at Chantilly, very close to CIA headquarters, there was a journalist who I knew at the time, who's died now, is James Tucker. He wrote an article called Bilderberg Are Plotting to Bushwhack Iraq, and he published that on the 7th of April 2002. And he was saying that these were the leaks that had been coming out of the people who were attending that Bilderberg conference over near CIA headquarters.
General Wesley Clark in the United States, who's a pretty hawkish character, but he's on the record as saying, well, I was told after 9/11 that we were going to invade seven countries, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya.
In 5 years.
In 5 years. And we've pretty much stuck to the schedule as proposed.
So this is the project...
Apart from the fact that every time they invade somewhere, they get their backsides kicked and therefore they get slightly deterred from the next madcap scheme.
The project for the new American century, effectively, the neocons in the US.
Yeah. Well, that's right, and I think the Russian general staff are pretty clear about what they're up against. General Ivashov, who's in command of the Russian armed forces on 9/11, is on the record as saying, well, we know what happened there. That was an inside job, and the purpose of that was so that you could start a war in the Middle East and against all these other countries, and the ultimate goal, target of all of this is us and the Chinese. But you may have fooled your own public, you may have fooled your own low-level military, but you're not going to fool us. It's our job to know what you do, and we do know what you do, and you are aggressive chancers.
Well, you're talking about,
and they are.
You're talking about the impeachment of Blair. This has been in one of these news reports this week about this. Triggering the process apparently requires an MP simply to propose a motion and support evidence as part of a document called the Article of Impeachment. If the impeachment attempt is approved by MPs, the defendant is delivered to Black Rod ahead of a trial. So in a way, it's the House of Commons being used as a kind of court of law.
Yeah.
A simple majority is required to convict, at which point a sentence can be passed. Last year, current Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn said the former Prime Minister could be made to stand trial for war crimes, saying that he thought the Iraq war was an illegal one and that Mr Blair has to explain that. He added, we went into a war that was a catastrophe, that was illegal, that cost us a lot of money and cost a lot of lives. The consequences are still being played out with migrant deaths in the Mediterranean and refugees all over the region. It's believed that 2.6 million word report due to be published in July, that's just been published, that's chill got, will not make any judgments on the legality of the war. But Martin, the International Criminal Court are saying that they won't try Tony Blair, but the House of Commons possibly could.
Yes, and don't forget the International Criminal Court is a very flawed institution. It's set up really only to prosecute people that the West doesn't like. And it's not really an independent court. And in any case, the Americans haven't signed up for the International Criminal Court because they know if they did, their people would have to stand trial.
No, but the British have, and Tony Blair possibly has.
Well, indeed. So if there was an impeachment proceedings in the House of Commons, that could lead to him, you know, the punishment being him being sent to the Hague.
But the effect of all of this is really damning for morale of the army. They're basically doing an illegal war, which has been more of a disaster than if they had just stayed at home, shall we say, just sitting in deck chairs.
Well, the British military have allowed itself to become a mercenary force for the neocons in the United States.
Well, hang on a minute, because actually the military have surely done the right thing here. If the democratically elected government tell them to go to war somewhere, they should do it. They shouldn't say, oh, we don't fancy this
well,
war.
Well, no. I did mention this in the first hour, and I cannot remember the name of the head of the armed forces at the time. It was an Admiral Sir Michael Boyce. I've remembered now. Sir Michael Boyce. He was interviewed by Paxman about all of this, and he said, well, I insisted that the Prime Minister came up with a piece of paper that said that the war was legal. And then Paxman said to him, well, you knew that that wasn't a really legal statement. He said, yes, but the point of that was that he's given me a piece of paper that says it's legal. That means he's to blame if it's not legal.
This
not
legal
me.
Piece of paper, I mean, it's a bit of a joke, really, isn't it, that something hinges
Indeed.
On that. But it was written by Lord Goldsmith at the time, very, very controversially, and also allegedly edited by Lord Falconer, who's one of the people who's just resigned from Jeremy Corbyn's cabinet, cabinet.
And his deputy, who's Elizabeth somebody, I can't remember the name, she resigned because she said this isn't legal. Now, what Paxman said to Sir Michael Boyce was, well, you knew that it wasn't a really legal document, and therefore, you know, you shouldn't have agreed with it. He said, yes, but the point is that Blair would go to the Hague and not me. Now, I would argue that it was Admiral Sir Michael Boyce's duty as the head of the British Armed Forces to say, unless you can give me a legal justification for this war, we're not going to do it. Because in actual fact, the Nuremberg principle is absolutely clear. You are absolutely forbidden to obey illegal orders. And all modern training for officers includes the Geneva Convention, Nuremberg principles, etc. So in actual fact, by agreeing to go to war on the basis of a document that wasn't a legal document, in actual fact, I don't think the soldiers do let themselves off. So Michael Boyce should have resigned at that point and refused to do what Blair was asking him to do. That was his duty as the commander of Britain's armed forces. He didn't do it. He went away for a nice retirement and no doubt a big pension at our expense. But lots of other people didn't come home.
Martin, some people are saying that there's actually part of a much bigger plan, something called the Yinon Plan, which is from 1982. An Israeli general decided that he wanted the Middle East balkanized.
Yes, I mean, there's a congruence between the desire to capture resources of the project from the New American Century in the US, you know, the City of London and Wall Street and all these people, the military-industrial complex, and the particular geopolitical needs of the Israeli state. They want to create war and conflict within the countries around them so that they can rule the roost, basically. And if you think back to apartheid South Africa, bad as it was inside South Africa, the real criminality of the apartheid regime was the wrecking of Mozambique and Angola through interference by South African and Western subversive forces, which led to the deaths of millions. And, of course, the destruction of the Middle East by the Israelis working in tandem with the Americans and the British is, I mean, and don't forget, this is part of the world where half the population is under 25. We are creating a time bomb of bitterness and resentment towards us. And I hope if any of those people, that's why we demonstrated, try and show those people we're not going along with this. We're being dragged kicking and screaming. And I think people in the Middle East appreciated that.
Yeah, Lord Falconer was on BBC's Question Time last night, and I do sometimes despair of the BBC with all the massive resources that they've got that they didn't put the question to him about why did you alter the legal advice to make it look as if there was a proper case for war. Anyway, he was defending Tony Blair's decision to say, well, actually, he thought removing Saddam Hussein was the right thing to do, and he got an absolute pasting from the audience at Question Time. But ultimately, there has been no kind of real legal decision about anybody that's been involved in these massive amount of deaths and this appalling military intervention. Ultimately, though, I talked about this Yinon plan. What do you think is the chance that actually what we're getting is we're getting people acting to an Israeli general's orders rather than to anything to do with democracy?
Well, the Israelis have their own agenda. So they, of course, have tried to provoke the Western forces into conflicts to say, for their own purposes. So in the 1950s, in the Lavon affair, bombs went off outside British and American consulates and so on in Egypt, which were blamed on Islamic extremists in order to try and make, you know, the Egyptian government persona non grata with the Western powers. The Egyptian police captured the perpetrators. They were Israeli agents. And that the Israelis have always operated in that way. They go around creating conflict in order to drag the bigger powers, the Western powers in particular, into sorting out their problems for them. They wanted Saddam Hussein taken down, and the Americans and the British, not the French and the Germans, obliged. But, of course, there were other forces at work. Who wanted, it's not, the Israelis don't determine everything to do with Western policy. It's an alliance, the real axis of evil, which is the right wing in Israel, the United States and Britain, in which I include Tony Blair.
It certainly seems to benefit the state of Israel having a kind of chaotic Middle East around it, doesn't it? But we've just seen, I mean, obviously there's a lot of accusations, fingers pointing at the Israeli government, saying what you're doing to the Palestinians is a form of apartheid, which is every bit as bad as what South Africa was doing in the 1980s. And that was overturned. That was a successful movement to boycott South Africa. There is also a building movement to boycott Israel. And as a result of that seen as a threat by the Israeli government, by people like Netanyahu, rather than dealing with the racism within their own country and within their own government, what they're doing is actually is this week on a charm offensive going all around Africa, Netanyahu, trying to charm the African leaders to voting pro-Israel at the United Nations.
Yes, and he's giving these various dictators in Africa, which many of which are supported by our own government, various incentives to support him. Of course, just as I made the point earlier, the real crimes of the apartheid regime were not in South Africa itself. They were in the countries surrounding South Africa, which were completely devastated. Mozambique and Angola have still not recovered from the devastation inflicted on them by the apartheid regime in that era. And, of course, the Western intelligence services were right in there with them. MI6 and CIA in the forefront, supporting Savimbi in UNITA in Angola and RENAMO in Mozambique.
Back in 2003, one of the really principal people who resigned from Tony Blair's cabinet was Robin Kirk, and it wouldn't be complete talking about Iraq without hearing from him.
I applaud the heroic efforts the Prime Minister has made in trying to secure a second resolution. But the very intensity of those attempts underlines how important it was to succeed. Now that those attempts have failed, we cannot now pretend that getting a second resolution was of no importance. France has been at the receiving end of bucket loads of commentary in recent days. It is not France alone that wants more time for inspections. Germany wants more time for inspections. Russia wants more time for inspections. Indeed, at no time have we signed up even the minimum necessary to carry a second resolution. We delude ourselves if we think that the degree of international hostility is all the result of President Chirac. The reality is that Britain is being asked to embark on a war without agreement in any of the international bodies of which we are a leading partner. Not NATO, not the European Union, and now not the Security Council. To end up in such diplomatic weakness is a serious reverse. Only a year ago, we and the United States were part of a coalition against terrorism, which was wider and more diverse than I would ever imagine would be possible. History will be astonished at the diplomatic miscalculations that led so quickly to the disintegration of that powerful coalition.
That's the voice of Robin Cook, the very honourable Foreign Secretary who resigned in the run-up to the invasion, illegal invasion of Iraq. Martin, he subsequently died, didn't he? But also, he just before he died, in July the 8th, 2005, wrote a Guardian article where he said the struggle against terrorism cannot be won by military means.
Yes, and he also pointed out that Al-Qaeda was originally, it means the base, and it was originally a database, a hard drive, held in the capital of Jordan, Amman, by Western intelligence services, of all the jihadi extremists from Libya and elsewhere who'd been armed and trained and infiltrated into Afghanistan by our intelligence services and special forces. And, of course, that whole Operation Cyclone, as it was called, the biggest undercover operation in history, was funded through the selling of heroin on the streets of Bristol and other major cities in the Western world. All of that is history, indisputable history. But we still talk as if we are whiter than white and we occasionally make mistakes, but in general we're trying to do the right thing. That is simply wrong. We are the criminals that we claim other people to be.
Bin Laden was, Robin Cook says, though, a product of a monumental miscalculation by Western security agencies. Throughout the 1980s, he was armed by the CIA and funded by the Saudis to wage jihad against the Russian occupation of Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda, literally the database, was originally the computer file of the thousands of mujahideen who were recruited and trained with help from the CIA to defeat the Russians. Inexplicably, and with disastrous consequences, it never appears to have occurred to Washington that once Russia was out of the way, bin Laden's organisation would turn its attentions to the West. So, fascinating bit of insight from Robin Cook there just a few days before he died.
Yeah, but it's also, to my mind, a limited hangout. Al-Qaeda remained a creature of
remember,
the West.
Remember, this is 2000... Martin, just a minute, because remember, this is 2005. Bin Laden's kind of gone out of the picture. Al-Qaeda is almost being embraced by the Americans now.
Well, yes, in the last 2 or 3 years, the al-Nusra Front in Syria, we are begging, and the British and the Americans are begging the Russians not to bomb them because they are moderate rebels and we've armed and trained them. And that means chaps from Hereford, from the SAS, have been arming and training them. Not in Afghanistan in the 1980s, but in Jordan and Turkey. Turkey's our NATO ally, Jordan's our Middle East ally, the Saudis are our allies. We armed and trained ISIS and Al-Qaeda to try and overthrow the government of Bashar al-Assad. So not only have we learned no lessons from the 1980s, I would put it to you that virtually all of these jihadi groups are in fact still under the control of the Western intelligence services. They were under their control in the 1980s, they are still under their control now. The Saudis cannot move without the support of the British and the Americans. And the Israelis, of course, are very much in bed with the Saudis. And so when Jeremy Corbyn the other day said, we do not blame Muslims around the world for ISIS any more than we blame Jews around the world for the misbehaviour of Israel. And there were howls of outrage from the pro-Zionist
lobby.
He didn't
actually say ISIS. He said groups like ISIS. Like ISIS. He was talking about... these jihadi groups.
Yes. Yeah, so in other words, there was then howls of outrage from the Zionist lobby saying, how dare you compare the state of Israel with ISIS and jihadi groups? But the fact is that the Israeli military, the British military, the Turkish military, the Qatari military, the Saudi military have all been supporting these jihadi terrorists. In actual fact, they've been coming into Israel to have operations, bullets removed, etc., and then been infiltrated back into Syria. So it's a perfectly legitimate point to make. And of course, what Cook is doing there is he's speaking within the mainstream, where you can't actually call a spade a spade. The fact is that virtually all jihadi terrorism, both internal within the Middle East and within our own countries, is still, to my mind, virtually entirely under the control of Western intelligence services. Not entirely, because these things are never completely fixed. But that's what we've seen in Syria over the last 3 years makes it absolutely clear.
OK, one of the most important intelligence insiders in the run-up to the illegal invasion of Iraq is Susan Lindauer. She suffered a year in jail to keep her out of the way and was threatened even with being drugged to become a permanent zombie. Let's hear now from an interview which we'll be hearing in full at 12 noon next Tuesday here on the Dialect programme. Susan Lindauer had quite a lot to say, particularly about what she thought about Tony Blair, Jack Straw, and David Kelly.
In Britain, I would definitely point my finger at Tony Blair and Straw. Shameful for performances. I was so grievously offended and furious that Tony Blair dared to blame the intelligence community on this. Mr. Chilcott is correct. There was a lot of good intelligence coming out of MI6. good intelligence warning them exactly what was going to happen. The consequences were well anticipated, but Mr. Kelly, for example, is a good example of somebody who paid the ultimate price, who was suicided to keep him quiet, to protect Tony Blair. I'd blame Mr. Tony Blair for Mr. Kelly's death, frankly. And it was just, it was a disgraceful performance. These leaders who demanded the war, who forced our country into the most devastating conflict, which is continuing to burn and is going to continue to explode for the next 100 years. This is the turning point of history, in my opinion. The Iraq War is the turning point of history. And Tony Blair forced our country into war, our world into war, and then lacked the courage and integrity to take responsibility for his own decisions. And I know for a fact that some factions of British intelligence tried to warn them. And in an intelligence game, it's always about factions. So some factions are in power, some are on the outs. But the British government, as you can see watching the – if you watch just the Labour Party and the Tories fight it out on the floor in Parliament, you have a healthy democracy, a healthy a community of voices that are chomping and loud, and they're noisy, and democracy is so exciting and so difficult because of those different voices. But I promise you, everyone was screaming for them to stop. There were a lot of voices, very smart people, saying exactly what Mr. Chilcott has said. They were treated abominably by Tony Blair. So if you want the responsibility of office, you'd better be ready to shoulder the responsibility of the job.
Susan Lindau there, who was one of the back-channel negotiators in the run-up to the 2003 illegal invasion of Iraq, Martin. What she's saying there is pretty much, a lot of it is written in her book, Extreme Prejudice, The Terrifying Story of the Patriot Act and the Cover-Ups of 9/11 and Iraq. But she's saying there that actually some of the major channels, intelligence channels, were getting all the correct information.
Well, that's right. And I think I remember seeing George Joffe speak, who was Britain's top expert on Iraq, and the civil service insisted that he had half an hour with Tony Blair before he went to war in Iraq. And I saw him speak, and he said, well, I went along to this meeting, and in the half hour I had to speak with Blair, I explained the complexities of the situation, the Sunnis, the Shias, all the problems that would ensue. And Blair turned around at the end of the meeting and said, but he is evil, isn't he? Meaning Saddam Hussein. And this is the top expert on Iraq, was sent by the civil service to talk to Tony Blair, and all he wanted to know, but is Saddam evil? Yes, he is. That's all I need to know. Now,
Susan also had quite a lot to say about Colin Powell as well.
Colin Powell is a gentleman whom I despise. I put him into the same category as Tony Blair and Foreign Minister Straw. I visited him twice before his speech at the United Nations. I delivered him first the copies of the Iraqi peace option so that he would know what options were available. And the second visit, I communicated to him that the Iraqi exiles were fabricating wild lies, wildly inventing stories because they had no support inside Iraq. They desperately needed the United States to send soldiers to force their way into power because they would never have any chance of rising on their own. And so I said, we're being manipulated by the exiles because they have no natural constituency at home. They've been out of the country for 30, 40 years. Nobody knows them. All the Iraqi people know is that the exiles supported the sanctions. The sanctions are hated. The exiles are hated. They've got no future. And so they are fabricating information because they have no other way of getting back into Iraq. And I was dead on the mark accurate. Let me tell you what Colin Powell did. Colin Powell turned that information over to the FBI. When he decided to whitewash the blood and dirt off his cowardly uniform, he, on September 8th, 2005, he gave a powerful interview to a journalist named Barbara Walters, declaring that it was the mid-level people at the CIA who failed to speak up and warn him about the bad intelligence he was getting from Iraqi exiles. And except for the tiny little problem that I had done so, and he had turned my papers over to the FBI. That was on that broadcast on September 8th. On September 17th, I was declared, quote, not competent to stand trial. So I had been accused of being an Iraqi agent for opposing the Iraq war because they said it was traitorous. I was committing treason because I had spoken out against the Iraqi war. But I was demanding my right to due process. I was demanding a trial. So what they declared was that I was not competent to stand trial, not competent to assist my attorney. And on September 23rd, 2 weeks after Colin Powell's speech, I was summoned into court and ambushed, ordered to surrender to prison without a trial or a hearing. And on October 3rd, I did, in fact, surrender to prison on Carswell Air Force Base. So the whole thing in a space of less than a month, from September 8th to October 3rd, I am cleared out of the way so that Colin Powell can go out and give his grand tour of pouting and petulance, you know, declaring how bad the intelligence community was, that nobody came and told him, and it was our fault, it was never his fault, he's not responsible for this mess, don't blame me. And I was locked up in prison for a year.
So how did Susan cope a year in jail when she hadn't even had a trial?
It was the most terrifying experience of my life. And I'm not saying that anybody who goes to prison it's very unpleasant. Nobody wants to do that. Don't break the law. It's an awful experience. But my case was traumatizing because I was denied the right to a trial. What they wanted to do was to lock me up for 10 years in prison. They actually petitioned the court to do this. Lock me up for 10 years, declaring that I was not competent and therefore I should be denied the right to a hearing in case perhaps I could bring witnesses or prove evidence that my story was true. And while I would be locked up for 10 years, I would be put into a straitjacket and tied down and forcibly injected with drugs that would chemically lobotomize me so that my brain would be cooked. And I would be, until I was so wrecked and ruined and physically destroyed, that I would never be a threat. The truth of what I knew would never be a threat to anyone like Tony Blair or George Bush or Dick Cheney or Colin Powell. What scum. That's why I have to tell you, I admire Mr. Chilcott's report very much. And to me, it's personally significant. And the only thing I would add to it, that he may not know. They may know this or they may not. They do know that MI6 possessed this information about the real good quality information about what would happen, and that it is not hindsight. Everyone talked about it during the period of time. The one thing that I would add is that while the official channel at the CIA did not share this, our warnings, did not share the peace option, did not share the fears and the catastrophic analysis, behind the scenes, the individual assets like myself, we did make sure you got it. So we were trying to be good allies to the British by making sure that even if it didn't go through official channels, we took this to the Labour Party. And we took this to Tony Blair's own, not his, I guess you call them a shadow cabinet. I don't know that these people were on his shadow cabinet. They may have been. Some of them may have been. But I was sending information all over Britain. All over the Parliament.
Susan Lindau there. She's the author of a book called Extreme Prejudice, The Terrifying Story of the Patriot Act and the Cover-Ups of 9/11 and Iraq. Knows a lot about Lockerbie too, Martin. She's also saying this has been devastating for the US morale in the military. Completely devastating.
Well, they haven't actually won the war since World War II. They've fought a lot and they've lost a lot. and that's because they picked the wrong wars in the wrong places.
She's saying there that the good information was supplied to MI6. We've seen today, or maybe this is going to be in tomorrow's Daily Mail, how MI6 fell under the spell of Number 10, writes Peter O'Born, while MI5 did its job. He explains how security agencies had vastly different ways of dealing with Blair before the Iraq War.
Well, as Susan Lindar pointed out, intelligence work is all about factions. I still think that it was a crime, not a mistake.
OK, Martin, well, let's hope some of those people get some punishment and some justice for the hundreds of thousands of people that have suffered. And as Susan said, a kind of turning point of history in a negative direction. Terrible crime. Anyway, that's all for this week. Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. We're online at thisweek.org.uk. And I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling.
This is Bristol.
Do please join us on the Politics Show at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we interview Berkeley City Council member Chris Worthington and two reference librarians, Pat Mullen and Andrea Siegel, regarding the forced removal of thousands of books from Berkeley Public Library, a condition happening to public libraries nationwide. For the second half of the show, we'll interview Dr. Lon Lay regarding civilian oversight and so-called less lethal technologies for domestic law enforcement. Please stay with us.
Perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitual lies, alibis, skies, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On the first part of the program today, we are going to look at an issue that's happening in Berkeley, but also around the country that involves, well, it involves labor issues, it involves censorship. A little introduction here. Last summer, the library director at the Berkeley Public Library was forced to resign after staff and public protests about his directives to send thousands of books from the library collection to what they refer to as a mattress pauper. This means that they're discarding the books, and to cut 34 librarians out of the selection process. What we have here is an issue that seems to involve a form of censorship and a lack of due process for tossing out these books, but there's also a whistleblower action going on inside the Berkeley Library for people that had made the public knowledgeable that this process was occurring. Here's Peter to interview our guest today.
Well, starting, our first two guests today are Chris Worthington. He's a city council member in Berkeley, has been there for 19 years, a long-term public service career and involved in progressive values. And also joining us today is Pat Mullen, a reference librarian, 25 years in the field, worked for the Public Bay Area Library Consortium, Alameda County, Oakland Libraries, now retired and pursuing the jazz trombone and heading the Berkeley Public Library Arts and Music Department for a good period of time. Welcome, Pat, and welcome, Chris. Could one of you give us kind of a background history of this? What are the issues and what's happened the last year? And then we'll take it up to the present.
Thanks for the chance. If it was a bad movie, you couldn't believe it anymore. About to say that Berkeley Public Library has been for decades a destination library. It's had a great funding base, taxpayer support, very consistent, and a very good staff, a terrific collection built up over time. So coming into this situation in about November of 2014 was a brand new library director by the name of Jeff Scott. He lasted 10 months. Mr. Scott's policy, starting in January of 2015, was to centralize the collection development and centralize book buying in the library system. That sounds pretty placid and sort of librarian-like, but how this was instituted was basically, in the nutshell, instead of 34 professional librarians or subject specialists in their field working in a team collegially buying the books for the library, he changed this to two managers only. And the 34 librarians who had previously been doing that had no access anymore to buying books, to weeding books, or to a book budget. This basically is a aberration against the librarian's job description. The official job description of librarian two for the city of Berkeley is that you develop the collection, you buy the books, you weed the books. But this was a new plan, and unfortunately, it's not the only place in the nation where this is going on. The top-down, heavy-duty, corporate-style business model management of libraries of our public trust is evidently alive. Through the course of the first half of the year, last year, 2015, Mr. Scott and his two managers weeded, tossed out 39,000 items from the collection, and he, up until his last week or so, was able to say, no, only 2,200. So we had a big problem with facts and with the fact that these 39,000 items which were tossed were done only on the basis of their circulation. Rather than a professional librarian going to the shelf and picking these books out that were dated or damaged, a computer-generated printout dictated what was to go out the back door.
That obviously seems to lack significant intellectual integrity.
Unfortunately, yes. And the idea of what would become with weeded materials, there's many different things you can do except besides sending them to a mattress pulper. The months went by before it was clear whether the books had been pulped or not. But the concept of having only very entry-level staff driving book trucks around and tossing them out, every librarian has responsible, thoughtful, intellectually based weeding tendencies in their DNA. And never have the current librarians, or even us that are retired happily, been at issue about the idea of weeding at all. You have to weed in your own garden. You have to weed your own little collection in your home just to make room for the new stuff to come in. This has not been an issue at Berkeley. There's plenty of money, and there's plenty of space, and evidently there's plenty of need for control from the top.
I'm looking at this list of books that have been weeded out in this past year, and I'm seeing people I know, like Michael Parente, Power and the Powerless. His book is gone. Judy Berry, Timber Wars. Studs Terkel. So a variety of very well-known authors and very high-quality books that librarians would know are part of a genre, part of a history of significant work, certainly Judy Berry's Timber Wars. I can't imagine any library not having that or retaining it. So that becomes because someone hadn't checked it out, it's just computer-generated, and they get rid of it?
Yeah. Of the 39,000 items like this, and if you get a list, which we do have, of the author title, little bibliographic information on each. This fills up the size of three big telephone books. There's something in this list of 39,000 items for everyone to feel that sinking feeling in their stomach that this was something that was no way going to go out the door. And of that 39,000, 13,800 were last remaining copies, meaning there are no duplicates of that title in the system. We would like people to respond to this issue, if possible, by just going to the website of this little ad hoc retired librarian and supporters organization that's having another petition drive now about this issue, www.savethebplbooks.org.
It sounds like you're describing a corporate model of management turning into Fahrenheit 451. This is an incredible story. And Chris Worthington, Berkeley City Council member, how did you get involved?
Well, riffing off of Pat calling it a movie, I would say last year's movie was Library Gate 1, which was about, you know, the inaccurate information and claiming that they weren't getting rid of the books. And it was only after the librarian whistleblowers told us how to use the computer codes on the library's own computers, and we showed the director that the numbers he gave were wrong, that then we were able to prove that, you know, they were, you know, misleading or themselves confused. So this year, LibraryGate 2, the horror movie, is this year they're trying to toss the workers who were the whistleblowers who exposed the inaccurate information. So last year they tossed tens of thousands of books, and this year they're threatening to toss multiple employees, some people say seven employees. It's hard to imagine that six or seven of the main people who really raised questions and showed us how to use the computer codes and signed petitions and spoke at public meetings, the very whistleblowers who were exposing the falsehoods, they're being threatened with suspension or termination, and the library is spending up to $45,000 for a contract to investigate them and try to nail them for little tiny technical mistakes that they might have made. It just seems like more than a curious coincidence that it happens to be the outspoken whistleblowers who are threatened with punishment.
This is a microcosm of what's happening in Obama's America with the war on whistleblowers right here in Berkeley, California. Peter?
This plays out nationally, we think, and certainly top-down management, monetary cutbacks require staff cutbacks, or so they will say, weeding out of books and that. Is this a dumbing down of our library system?
You take the words right out of our mouths. Unfortunately, the way that the current appointed membership of the Board of Library Trustees in Berkeley is operating is quite pulled back from what the community, who has shown up to many meetings and rallies and written their letters and petitions and talked to their city council people, and also the staff have been trying to discuss with them for now over a year and a half. It's an idea that must come from people who are appointed to a job or a task like this Board of Library Trustees membership from their own backgrounds. Maybe Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Stanley have something to do, an interest in real estate rather than the people who are using the public buildings, has some driving force. Even at that, it seems that a public trust, if you're on a board or commission, whatever the topic is across the country or in this town, you would have an inclination to appear to listen. And maybe after appearing to listen, you would be able to actually hear what the people are trying to say. Because even though the librarians in our group and across the country lost their buns and their shushing mentality a long time ago, we are librarians, and we're not going to burn the building down, but we are going to talk about what's inside it and what's going on. And it is a very frustrating experience for not just the public, who are pretty much stonewalled at these various meetings, but completely for the staff, who are either actively trying to support what the whistleblowers themselves are doing over the past months, or just maintaining themselves going into a job on a daily basis, how hard it is to go in. But as Chris mentioned, the thousands of books that were tossed out the back door last year now result, the further result is numbers of staff threatened to be tossed either out the front or the back door this year. We need, as active readers, if nothing else, active members of the community to speak up and make our voices heard, not only to the Board of Library Trustees in Berkeley, but their city council members.
To me, the most frightening aspect of all of this is the potential national precedent. If Berkeley, the home of the free speech movement and a bastion of liberal thought, and if in Berkeley the whistleblowers who complain, and it is absolutely proven that the librarians' complaints were right. The whistleblowers were right. We now have proof. We have printouts. We have the names of all the books. The librarian whistleblowers were right, and they happen, curiously, coincidentally, to get removed from their positions, some of them suspended, some of them terminated. That's a horrible message across the nation. If the, you know, the corporate mentality can succeed at punishing whistleblowers in Berkeley, what's going to stop them doing it anywhere else across the nation?
And there are certainly movements of censorship and movements to purge works across the country. Rather commonplace, of course. You know, we work with Banned Books Week and ALA Office of Intellectual Freedom and so forth, and you're all nodding, of course, approvingly. Yes.
Censorship had many forms. And,
it does.
And we're all...
This is another.
This
is an assault on the commons, really. It's an enclosure movement on the commons of the public library coming from within management in the library.
We need a little different approach, and it's there. It's not lost yet. There's plenty of interest in dialogue and putting in a collegial form. There's many ways of organizing to buy books. We don't have to do the old way that it had been happening when Neanderthal people like me used to work there. I've been out for 10 years. But there are many ways to go. And as I mentioned, censorship does come in many forms. And using this business model of removing the stock from the shelf if it doesn't move quite fast enough in a time period, that doesn't necessarily meet the needs of the community. So as a result of this rampant weeding, even though that former director was forced to resign after 10 months, we're still left with his policies, and the community itself has lost a significant part of its heritage and legacy.
Indeed, that is librarian Pat Mullen. We're also joined by Berkeley City Council member Chris Worthington. We want to bring another librarian, Andrea Siegel, into the conversation. We will do that after this short musical break. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips, and this is the Project Censored Show. Stay tuned. To the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On this segment of the program today, we're talking about thousands of books being purged from the Berkeley Public Library. It's a condition happening at libraries nationwide. We were joined by librarian Pat Mullen. We are still joined by Berkeley City Council member Chris Worthington, and we're now joined by another reference librarian, Andrea Siegel. So, Andrea Siegel, let's bring you into the conversation and carry on this conversation about what exactly is happening inside the library and this retaliation against the librarian whistleblowers.
Yeah, thanks for having us. We're trying to get the word out because it is pretty difficult, given how the board structures its minutes and meetings, for the public to hear it. If you look at any of their minutes, you'd kind of have no idea that anything controversial was going on. So we're grateful for this opportunity. As Pat said, we came into this when librarians who are currently working there, many of them are people that Pat and I have known for decades. They're just a great group of people, passionate about providing information in an equal, open basis, the most amazing democratic way. All economic levels, all groups have access to our most beloved democratic institution, the public library. And they tried really hard last year to have their voices being heard. They were very concerned about what was going on with this radical change in policy, locked out of their Baker and Taylor accounts, weren't able to read book reviews. It was really dramatic. And when they finally had absolutely no voice in the workplace, they ended up going public, writing a letter to the board, asking the board to slow this down. Let's go back and talk about what's going on. This is a terrible detriment to the community. And when we saw that was a public statement, then we realized, you know, it's unfortunate, but we know this from the past, that there is retaliation in many of these kinds of cases, and they need community support, and they needed it then. We came forward and formed a group trying to help support them. Right now, why we're here particularly today is we're on a campaign, an email campaign, and could really use your help. If you folks can, if your listeners could go to our website, savethebplbooks.org, and sign the petition if this resonates with you, which I hope it will. I mean, the librarians, they are fighting for the fact that it's really important to have a lot of people having input into what goes into the collection and what goes out of the collection. If you just turn over what they're doing at Berkeley, if you turn it over to two people managing a multi-million dollar materials budget, which in turn will be turned over to corporate America, like groups like Baker and Taylor, who are jobbers for books, you know that you're losing a lot of local control in the particular things that public libraries are noted for. You just look at a bestseller list. Bestseller lists nationally are so different than Bay Area bestseller lists. I mean, anybody knows that. And even within library communities, different branches have different community interests and will tailor what they have in their collection and what goes out of their collection based on that community. So to have this cookie-cutter approach where a large corporation is deciding, and, you know, you have to really follow the money on a lot of this stuff. It's in their interest, a lot of these jobbers, to have libraries say, oh, this hasn't been checked out for a few years, toss it, and then just rebuy it when people need it. And it's such a waste of money. People, even some of the other departments in the library have been outsourced, like mending departments and things like that, where a book might have the slightest amount of wear, and you can just repair it and use it rather than tossing it and rebuying it a few years later when, you know, a movie comes out or a tie-in or an art exhibition. So these are a lot of the issues that librarians are really fighting for. And not only are we trying to protect their jobs because it's so unfair, all they did was tell the truth last year, but we're also, if we lose these people, these are the people who are really fighting for the community. They're the ones who have laid it all out. They have absolutely nothing to gain except retaliation by speaking up. They come in and do their jobs. Pat and I know these people really well. They're the most honest, hardworking, passionate people about community information. And so please, you know, show your support. Tell the people, the powers that be, that, you know, this cannot be happening in Berkeley. We can't lose these people.
I think of a public library or any library as kind of a cultural archive of local people as well. And many times there's special collections and things like that. As we privatize, as we see this top-down management control of libraries in a, what I would call a very neoliberal fashion, not only purging libraries and purging books, there's a transformation of what the library is. And that, it seems to be one of the key things you're talking about. We're purging quality books, or books that belong in an archive in terms of our cultural history, and we're purging people that go with that, or people that have sounded out or resisted this kind of top-down control. I see Chris nodding his head here. So as a city council member, how does the city council play into all this?
Well, I think the whistleblowers issue is even larger than the issue of the weeding process, and I'm still cautiously optimistic that when the city council members and the library board really understand all the details, you know, that either the city council and or the library board will weigh in and say, wait a second, this smells to high heaven. You know, we need to intervene. We need to provide some policy direction. In Berkeley, the library board is appointed by the city council. And then it's sort of a semi-autonomous entity, although the money they spend is a part of the city budget, but it was designed to sort of keep it insulated from political pressure and be an independent entity. But ultimately, the city council gets to vote on who sits on the library board. Several of the library board members, a bunch of council members, didn't want to reappoint them because they were seen as unsympathetic and insulting to the community activists who were trying to name the South Berkeley branch after Tahria Hall Pittman, a loved and widely respected Berkeley African-American activist. And the library board bitterly resisted changing the name. So it took the city council sort of saying, wait a second, you really need to rethink this. And eventually they agreed to change it. And it's sort of ironic that in the very library, you know, South Berkeley Library, that's now the Tahria Hall Pittman branch, that's where the meetings are going on, where the community is coming and begging, pleading, pressuring to try to save the whistleblowers from getting tossed out just like the books were.
Well, I wanted to add here, you know, Ray Bradbury once said, I spent 3 days a week for 10 years educating myself in the public library, and it's better than college. People should educate themselves. You can get a complete education for no money. At the end of 10 years, I'd read every book in the library and written 1,000 stories. We're talking about an institution that's at the core of the commons of a free society, really, here. So, you know, getting under the big picture, this is as if it's a neoliberal assault on public institutions and the right for people to know what's going on, not only in the library and in the community, but their right to knowledge.
Exactly. I mean, when you talk to people, you will hear stories from almost everyone, like you mentioned about Ray Bradbury, people who have, you know, come here as immigrants, learned to read, to educate themselves. I mean, and even if some of your listeners are thinking, well, I don't go to the library all that much myself, it's used so heavily by children. I mean, the reading programs in the summer keep kids from falling back behind in their, and, you know, we want to have diverse books in those collections. We don't want to just have cookie cutter books. I mean, people who come here who are, you know, just, and not everyone can afford to buy every single book they need. And students, obviously, of all ages, we all remain students of some sort. To think of the fact that this would be controlled by corporate culture without input Some of the people on the staff, they're nationally recognized. They're people who are on American Library Association committees to award prizes and lists of the most award top books of the country. They're in the children's department. They're no longer involved. Why would we have people on our staff who are so skilled and qualified and nationally recognized and not have them have input? The board chair, you know, they keep saying, oh, well, they can make suggestions for purchase, but that falls short. Just having someone's job description change to the point that they're just an ordinary, you know, member of the public making suggestions, it's not the same as having a budget and looking at it and making wise decisions of what's going in and what's going out. It falls short of it.
And the library isn't just a place with books. It's the center of community. It's there's so many rich cultural events that take place there, and dialogues and conversations that take place there. And to see this kind of twofold, right, the issue going on here, the attack on whistleblowers, as Chris was mentioning, is very troubling from potentially a city council level. And then, naturally, the purging of books in such a, well, such a widget-like way is pretty alarming. I wanted to just very quickly remind people of the website, savethebplbooks.org. People can go there for more information. Peter?
Well, I simply Googled the Berkeley Library book purge, and it all came up as well. So it's easy to find. There's plenty of information out there on this issue, and it certainly is a national issue. You know, at state college libraries, I've watched the kind of limiting of what books you can buy and that kind of, and moving more towards electronic volumes.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's the other thing. They keep trying to say that these are just stick-in-the-mud people who just like books, but these librarians, they were so careful in selecting electronic databases and important resources, digital media for music, for opposing viewpoints. And a lot of this stuff has also been removed from the collection. So it's not just books, you know, Berkeley Library has been innovative in the past, the first library to introduce compact discs, tool lending, art slides. There are so many things, and this is an innovative group who even the electronic databases that they have selected have been wiped out. So there's so many, you know, levels.
And the big picture, it's as if an like assault, right, on the public commons. Chris Worthington.
The Bradbury quote really resonated with me. When I was 14, 15, and 16, I was a homeless teenager. And I sort of jokingly said at the time that the librarians saved my life. Not only was I a homeless teenager, I was a gay teenager, and these lesbian librarians sort of took me under their wings, and they not only invited me into the library, but they like pointed out things that I might be interested in reading that I'd never heard of, and I learned all kinds of history, and it was just like he was saying, the library was my I learned so much history and science. And, you know, as a homeless teen, I was struggling to survive, and they would, like, sneak me sandwiches. So when I'm thinking of these whistleblowers who are seemingly being punished for telling the truth and pointing out that the emperor didn't have any clothes on, that they were giving the city council inaccurate numbers about the tens of thousands of volumes, I just think back to those librarians, these librarians. Probably those librarians might have broken a rule by handing me a sandwich, and should they have been fired for, you know, trying to help keep me alive? And these people, you know, I'm sure they're not like writing a report saying you're going to be fired because you showed the computer codes to the city council and therefore, you know, you exposed that we were giving out false information. It's not that blatant, but if it happens to be coincidentally the same people, it's unbelievable as a coincidence. And I think stopping the people purge is equally and probably more important than stopping the book purge.
Indeed. Chris Worthington, Berkeley City Council. And Andrea Siegel, last words?
I just think that it's escalating at the library, and that's why we're in today. In May, the library union presented a letter of no confidence to the library board, and we understand that there were 56 signers. So when last year it was 10 or 15 librarians writing a letter, this year it's gone up, and librarians from every branch, every department are signing on, because it's just becoming a hostile workplace where people are, it's a chilling atmosphere, people are afraid to speak up, and with this kind of stuff going on, it's just got to stop, and we really need the public's outcry to let the powers that be know that this is not acceptable in the Berkeley Public Library.
reference librarian Andrea Siegel, and before that, Pat Mullen, thank you for your efforts in this important matter. Berkeley City Councilman Chris Worthington, thank you for coming in and talking to us about this very significant issue that's, again, a national issue. It's not something that's just here in Berkeley. It's going on at many other places. So thank you all for the work you're doing. And at Project Censored, longtime friends of the libraries and librarians, we certainly stand with you. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. For the second half of the show, we'll interview Dr. Lon Lay regarding civilian oversight and so-called less lethal technologies for domestic law enforcement. Please stay with us.
Hello, you're tuned in to KPFA, and this is the Project Censored Show. This program was previously recorded last week.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On this segment of the program, we'll be interviewing Lon Lay, and here is Peter to talk about Lon Lay. And we're looking into civilian oversight, less lethal technologies for domestic law enforcement, among other things. So, Peter?
Lon Lay is the president of the Institute for Good Government and Inclusion. That's a think tank that she helped put together a few years back. She has a PhD from Berkeley, 2010, and served as a director of research at UC Berkeley Center for U.S. Latino Policy Research, and was a visiting professor down at UCLA for a while at their Department of Political Science in the Department of Asian American Studies. She's a member of the National Association of Civilian Oversight of Law Enforcement. So that's what brings us here today, is to talk about some research work you have done on tasers and electronic weapons and civilian oversight and mortalities. I mean, certainly killing of people in the country. So that's a very big topic right now. So Lon Lay, tell us about the research piece, Civilian Oversight and Development of Less Lethal Technologies.
Peter and Mickey, thanks for having me on. This project came together because of what I learned about advances in less lethal tech, and also based on observations of the reports on taser deaths and taser injuries across the spectrum, across the country. So what we've seen in recent years is that there are new advances in less lethal tech, such that the new weapons coming into the pipeline are invisible to the naked eye and silent. So these will pose increasingly difficult challenges to oversight and auditing as they become implemented in our law enforcement agencies. I use the case of tasers or conducted energy devices to parallel what we might understand or predict based on injuries and other risks that arise from the implementation of tasers, given their similarity to the weapons that have been used or are of interest in law enforcement agencies, such as the long-range acoustic device or the active denial system. I'll talk about those a bit more in a moment, but I want to pause and see if you have any questions.
So you did comparative research between police agencies that had tasers and electronic weapons and those that did not, thinking that perhaps people, there would be less shootings by police officers. What were some of the results of that?
Well, we were really looking at, with tasers and a national data set with agencies that had implemented CEDs, whether tasers were used against suspects or subjects who were not resistant, absolutely not resisting, or only passively resisting, as in they were sitting on the ground. So in these cases, tasers should not be used because it's excessive force. This is consistent with court decisions and consistent with the official policies of many law enforcement agencies. Unfortunately, a significant proportion of subjects in the data set were subject to firing upon by tasers. And so what we see is 13% approximately of those who are active or not actively resisting or not resisting at all were subject to excessive force. And if we think about this, tasers have prongs. They can be audited because they're fired within visible distance at suspects. In contrast to the new weapons that are coming down the line that can be fired at suspects or subjects from half a mile away. And there are no prongs and there are no visible signs of injuries frequently. So, well, what we then have is a situation where we have the introduction and implementation of new weaponry coming into the pipeline that will be increasingly difficult to audit when we already have tremendous difficulty with tasers.
It almost sounds science fiction in some regard. I couldn't help but think about Star Trek phasers. I mean,
yeah.
This is a very advanced kind of technological way of assaulting. It's still assaulting people.
Well, tasers at one point seemed like they were high-tech, right?
But
then the National Institutes of Justice, which is the research arm of the Department of Justice, had to test tasers out on suspects, and they had medical personnel follow these suspects, follow officers around and witness them firing on suspects. And the poor original suspects, who must not have known what was happening to them, were being, in some sense, electrocuted,
yes.
and they must have freaked out in
yeah, well, it's interesting you bring up the NIJ because I was just looking at a study that they did a number of years ago where they suggested that less lethal weapons decrease rates of officer and offender injuries, and this was the argument. So is that in fact true?
Well, it's very possibly true. Less lethal weapons and the advance in technology may be welcome. There are an alternative to lethal weapons and a feasible one. But the difficulty they pose is in auditing and oversight and the implementation, the use of them against suspects who clearly should not be subject to use of force. We have to get that right. They are a feasible alternative, and in our study, we find that they are used against suspects who do threaten officers, who do pose severe aggression to officers and dangers to public safety on average. But the kicker is that at the bottom, where these suspects are not dangerous and posing no danger, they're also used disproportionately. There should be no use. No one should be fired on just by sitting there.
So if you're a young teen or a case we all saw on the internet, a grandma mouthing off at a police officer, maybe speaking back, and you're tased.
Yes, that is out of bounds. That's a use of excessive force. And courts have found that mouthing off is not a good reason for someone to be fired upon with a taser. The key decision is about reasonable force. And reasonable force hinges on the danger that the suspect poses to public or the officer at the time, the immediate danger, in addition to some other circumstances. But that's the core point. So mouthing off doesn't pose a real danger.
No, neither does swearing or cussing at a police officer. I'm not advocating people do that, but it's lawful as well to video police as long as you're not obstructing their activities. So maybe we need to take the fish out of the fishbowl for a minute so it can see the water. The bigger picture here is the culture of violence. Now, non-lethal, right, force, and you've clearly laid out that there are instances where it's purported these tools are necessary, right, that they have to use force, the law enforcement agencies need to use force or some modicum of violence to subdue people in a given situation, right? And you gave examples of, yes, that happens. But what about just the pervasive culture of violence in the United States and how the police are basically an arm of that? I mean, how much do you use that as a framework for doing any of the research?
We use the framework of militarization of law enforcement and displays in Ferguson with tear gas and heavy artillery. And this article speaks to the idea that we must follow the principle of respect for persons. And also implicitly, Americans are not the enemy. We should not be living in a war zone. And there are people who are dangerous in our country, but the average American is not an enemy. And I don't think that's a society we want to live in, and that's not a society we want our children to grow up in, a war zone at home.
Police have killed more Americans since 9/11 than died on 9/11, and we've invaded seven countries since then. And again, there's a culture of violence externally. There's a culture of violence internally. It seems like that's something that should be a bigger part of the focus of our national dialogue.
The Department of Justice has tried to orient policing towards community-oriented policing, but then there's been a shift away from it again. So it seems like there are solutions, they're tried, and then there's pressure against it. So this pressure towards militarization of law enforcement and new weapons, they really do challenge us. I do want to describe these new weapons, because we said they're almost Star Trek-y, but they're not. They're widely available. The Active Denial System, ADS, was developed and has been a weapon of interest by the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, a different version of it. It's the Active Denial System itself. That particular one is based on millimeter wave directed energy that can be targeted at an individual, and that individual is subject to intense pain and heating as if he or she were in an oven. Now, Raytheon and the NIJ have worked on portable versions of the Active Denial System. So if you can imagine these being implemented in the long run in our law enforcement agencies, they may be particularly dangerous because they, again, can be fired at a distance, and they're supposed to be safe. But if they're repeatedly fired at someone, then the effects can be lethal. And when experts on less lethal weapon technology have studied the effects, they say that when utilizers violate the standards for use, then you can produce second or third degree burns. So that's one. The long-range acoustic device has been acquired by the San Diego Police Department. That was in 2008. And the LRAD, if used improperly, can cause hearing problems. You can produce severe hearing problems if the target is too close and then the sound is projected at that target too loudly. There are portable versions of weapons based on sound, and these can direct sound only at a particular given target so that a target can hear something and be tortured, but the people around him or her might not witness it and then would not be able to verify it. So how do we, in the oversight and auditing community, take these weapons into account as they become miniaturized, made portable, and used? So that's one of the questions I've posed to the oversight community and also the inspectors general community. And in both communities, the question is very new and fresh. So I thank you for having me on, because it's a pioneering question that may affect all of us. And I don't want us to wait until there's national disasters. What we're seeing with tasers is something awful. And we don't have to wait for those same things to happen with these new advances in weaponry. And the new ones will be even more difficult to oversee. So I do have some recommendations on what to do and the challenges that the new weapons pose. They need oversight. So the new weapons should be manufactured such that each firing intensity, location, time is recorded automatically. And there should be a statistician who's collecting this data and analyzing it for outliers.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Geeter Phillips. Right now, we're speaking with Dr. Lan Lay regarding civilian oversight and less lethal technologies for domestic law enforcement. Lan Lay is one of the founders of the Institute for Good Government and Inclusion. We'll continue our conversation with Lan Lay after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Geeter Phillips. In a segment of the program today, we're speaking with Lan Lay of the Institute for Good Government and Inclusion. We're talking about civilian oversight and less lethal technologies for domestic law enforcement. Geeter?
Lan Lay, you're describing, let me see if I can get the summary here, conducted energy weapons and tasers are a part of that now. But then there's these advances, not only with sound, but with heat weapons and a variety of new technologies that are emerging. And your concern is, well, how can there be oversight of police, and how can we protect civilians, particularly from officers that are sadistic or use these for torture devices, without having some sort of monitoring and correction? And you were making some recommendations.
I mentioned that these weapons should be manufactured such that each firing is recorded with details for statistical auditing later. But secondly, civilian practitioners of oversight should gain access to training in cutting-edge methods of detection and forensics for these weapons. So there may be some high-speed cameras that could help with auditing to figuring out what kind of when they're abused. There's also other scientists who have come up with panels that can detect when a weapon's firing passes through it. Obviously, these are very expensive. So we do have to come together and have our experts think through how to audit these before we implement them, hopefully before we implement them widely. Less lethal weapons, their use should also be subject to substantial public discussion, right? So we want people to be engaged. Everyone has the right to public records requests by law, the people's business. So ideally, people in each community that is under the jurisdiction of a particular law enforcement agency would submit requests for use of force policies and try to analyze when these weapons are fired and how well they adhere to the use of force policies and whether the use of force policies should be revised. A lot of the time, people will say, well, we can rely on whistleblowers to make this right. So if somebody is misusing a weapon, it's impossible not to detect. But we do know, based on FBI, Government Accountability Office, and other news sources, including senior leaders in Congress, that FBI whistleblowers have a tough time. They face retaliation. They're confused about who they can report to. They can't just report to their immediate supervisors. They have to report to the Inspector General or a few other outlets. So it's difficult to say that we can sit back and wait for whistleblowers to do their job. They have tremendous challenges. If we can do anything to reward them when they do step forward, that would be particularly valuable. So those are some of the ideas that I have for how to address the upcoming challenges with the advances in less lethal tech. There is room for concern, and we haven't talked about that, but I do want to say that, you know, some of our most amazing moral and heroic figures are going to be in law enforcement and the military, but we cannot neglect the substantial literature that says we are humans, and that means there are high risks involved in abusing weapons like these. For example, there's new research by Buckles et al., 2013, from the University of British Columbia, and here they're examining everyday sadism. So this is subclinical sadism. This means people out and about with us. Sadists are people who want to hurt people and enjoy it, and they found that it's very common, actually, to have sadists. That's where bullying comes from. That's where a lot of these misbehaviors come from. So if we think about the implications of sadism for interacted with these weapons, then the probabilities of misuse increase. But you don't have to be a sadist in order to fire off these weapons and misuse them. In fact, Milgram studies, the classic studies in obedience, showed that subjects who were just listening to some guy in a lab coat were willing to shock someone up to 450 volts, which is severe, and two-thirds of them were willing to do this, in spite of the person being entirely innocent and often screaming in shock and saying he had a heart condition. So here is a situation where it's just a series of increasing tests on whether someone is going to shock someone at the maximum, and two-thirds of the subjects in the experiment went all the way. People say often that maybe Milgram studies were classics and people are different today, just like we said Americans are different from Germans in World War II. But here's the kicker on this one. When scholars re-examined the literature, they found that people are just as likely to obey today those kinds of orders, morally wrong orders, as they were previously.
Well, we saw that with the American Psychological Association and the psychologists being paid to teach the military torture techniques and these kinds of incredibly grotesque things. Go on. In the present, right? And I think also the continued use of the phrase less lethal, let's unpack that just for a minute for our listeners. Less lethal doesn't mean non-lethal.
Yeah, less lethal. They used to use non-lethal, but they switched to less lethal because they realized it's still lethal, potentially. To fire a taser at someone, they could fall down and hit their head.
Framing is important, right? Yeah, because it is part of propaganda. It's part of how people normalize the use of some of these kinds of things, because it's like, well, this has been vetted and this has a technical name and it must be okay. And it seems like that there needs to be a lot more discussion about that. And the civilian oversight ideas, right, it seemed to be a vehicle for such.
So these conducted energy weapons, not only potentially lethal, but you're saying they can be used and there would be no record of the pain and the torture that a person went through. Could be literally covered up more easily.
The CEDs or tasers traditionally right now in normal use have prongs. These can be audited. There are wireless versions that are coming down the line, though, so those are more difficult to audit. The other weapons I'm referring to are directed energy weapons or acoustic weapons. And so I should clarify the terminology. Mm-hmm. I'm using tasers, which are currently implemented broadly, as in 2011, with maybe more than 16,000 law enforcement agencies in the country. So those agencies have used tasers. And then the new weapons coming into the pipeline, for which we're seeing them used at protests occasionally, mm-hmm. those ones are the ones that are going to pose additional challenges because they don't have the prongs and the wires.
Directed energy weapons. Mm-hmm. Talk to us about that.
One example I discussed earlier, that was the active denial system, and that's the millimeter wave directed energy. And they're coming up with portable versions. It's still a challenge, but the weapons manufacturers have such a significant incentive to say these weapons are safe and to move forward with the rapid development. And I mean, how much of the discussion is public?
Not much. At Project Censored, we've talked about electromagnetic weapons. And, you know, people look at you sideways and they say, well, that sounds absurd. That's crazy. And you're crazy for talking about that. But it sounds like it's not crazy at all, and people should be talking about it.
I mentioned when I discussed this at a meeting in oversight, then someone came up to me from one of these agencies and said, that's exactly what we're grappling with right now on how to audit and do oversight for these weapons. And he was with one of these intelligence agencies. So, in fact, people are thinking about them. It's just one of these pioneering questions that we're trying to get a hold on, and it's not paranoia. The point of this article is if there's abuse, this kind of abuse with tasers, what kind of abuse are we going to see down the line? And the psychological literature, the expectation is that there will be abuse. It is not a question of whether. It is a question of when and in what circumstances. And what I want to do is say, we need to jump ahead and think, how can we identify what's going on and who is being abused? These weapons are extremely dangerous if misused. Tasers have guidelines as well. But even young adults, 20-somethings, fired on for more than the length of time that they should be fired on, they end up with brain damage. That's traceable because he's close enough. The person firing, he or she is firing on the subject, that they're close enough. But from half a mile to a mile away, no chance.
Dr. Lonley, you're the president of the Institute for Good Government and Inclusion, which is a think tank here in Berkeley that you helped found. Tell us a little bit about that and how people get more information from that.
Our website is www.thinkiggi.org/com. There you will find our mission, which is to conduct research and educate on issues of significant controversy. We are a domestic public policy think tank. We don't take foreign donations, which makes us distinct from the other think tanks. We don't think there should be any foreign influence in how we formulate our policy and ideas. We also, since we're addressing issues of significant controversy, we formally engage with the academy at conferences and through peer-reviewed publications, and we look forward to feedback. So we want to test our ideas and then get them out there. So that's how, as a think tank, we are a little bit different than simply self-publishing, which is no mean feat. We just take a different approach, particularly because we focus on issues of significant controversy and critically evaluating these issues with rigorous social science methodology. So there's a lot of stuff on the internet that I don't know whether to believe them or not. I think that's an interesting idea, but how would I test that? So that's what this think tank is about. There's a tough question out there. People are making claims, but we don't know how to test. We, the public, don't know how to test these claims, and we, as a think tank, want to go ahead and rigorously analyze these questions through public information requests, through analysis of survey data, and through interviews, among other approaches.
Sounds very much like you're interested in democracy, civilian oversight, keeping government transparent, and certainly we can't count on whistleblowers inside police departments because it's very, very difficult for them to come forward. The culture doesn't allow it, and there can be repercussions in many cases. So you're looking for ways to protect civilians from expanded use of these electronic weapons.
I also wanted to mention that this affects law enforcement families as well. There was recently a case where someone from a law enforcement agency, his son was fired on by another officer from a different agency. And he wasn't posing a danger, and the kid has brain damage from 20-something seconds of being fired on by this taser. And the officer ended up saying, well, he used to believe that law enforcement was always right, but now he understands there are tremendous abuses that pose dangers. So, you know, it's a concern for civilians, but for law enforcement families, it should concern everyone, because we all have children, and our children are not going around in uniform. We don't know who belongs to who or what. So that the line where we're reluctant to whistleblow or reluctant to report or reluctant to engage in these tough questions of auditing and oversight, they are for us all.
Indeed, and you know, earlier in the program we were talking about whistleblowers with librarians, but here we're talking about law enforcement. We're talking about people that are trained to use lethal force. We've certainly seen a spate of lethal force from law enforcement in the United States over the past decade. Wrapping up here, what exactly are you doing right now? What is something that's a major project that you're pushing right now? And what do you hope to be doing with your think tank over the next few years?
We are engaged actually simultaneously in several projects. One is on sexual harassment and assault in the military. This problem has plagued the military at least since 1991, Tailhook, where it made national media. But it's still, assaults and harassment are still going on. There are strides, but there's substantial retaliation still going on against those who come forward. Another project is medical ethics with medical school faculty, conflicts of interest in particular. Some of the major commissions that we have publicly announced that, wow, informed consent procedures are terrific. But in fact, there are all kinds of violations of informed consent, even at the University of California alone. If you Google the LA Times, we've had from pre-birth all the way to death violations of informed consent.
Well, they're even in the legislature. Where the legislature in Sacramento is passing laws against informed consent.
This is one of the issues we want to tackle. There's a think piece posted on one of the agency websites, Health and Human Services, I believe. I don't know if they've taken it down, where they want to say that informed consent doesn't matter for people who are suspects. Unfortunately, we cannot waive due process or the rights of suspects, but somehow there has been some policy advanced where if we don't push back on this idea that we are a special country that accords respect for persons, we will lose, at least in the short run, until there's pushback. Just like with community-oriented policing, pushing back. So we need to continue to engage in this discussion formally, and we need to think critically. We need to not trust simply because someone has a title. We need to think critically and grab the data, because we have rights to the data. We Americans can be empowered. When I was at UCLA, I taught my students the FOIA, and they were incredibly empowered at the end of that experience. So going forward, I want to continue with this research and education efforts. And we're a very green organization. We're only a year and a half old. We're based in Oakland.
Could you please give the website one more time?
ThinkIggy.com, ThinkIggy.com. Iggy stands for Institute for Good Government and Inclusion.
Well, Dr. Lan Lee, we couldn't agree more with you. Project Censored, we've covered many of the stories, the issues that you were describing over the years, and we continue to do that. And we would certainly be delighted to have you back on the program to talk more about the things that you're doing at your think tank. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you both for your pioneering efforts across a range of issues, actually.
That does it for the Project Censored show today. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We give special thanks to our producer, Anthony Fest. Our engineer is Erica Bridgman. The Project Censored show airs on 35 stations around the U.S. from Maui to New York. Archives can be found online at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time. Up next, Terra Verde.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
coming up next.
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The Earth wants you. Reverend Billy in his smart white suit and Elvis Presley hairdo is preaching the Stop Shopping Gospel while standing knee-deep in the rising floods of climate change. That's the photo on the cover of his recent book by City Lights, The Earth Wants You. A motivational handbook meant to inspire its readers to challenge the consumerism that is killing our planet. Bill Talon moved from San Francisco to New York City in the early 90s, after many years in Bay Area theater and performance art. There he began preaching on street corners in Times Square in front of Disney stores and advertising billboards. His solo appearances soon attracted crowds and sympathizers, and the Church of Stop Shopping was born. That Church of Stop Shopping now has several thousand members and a professional, highly acclaimed multicultural choir.
Shopping gets me depressed, but what really gets me down is that damn convenience.
That's a clip from Shopocalypse, the Stop Shopping Choir's latest release, The Earth Wants You. Choir and preacher Billy may take over bank lobbies, appear in the aisles of Walmart, at Starbucks and Disneyland, or at Monsanto shareholder meetings. Instead of feeling honored to get professional performances with 30 people in costumes or extinct animal masks and always well-researched information on flyers, bankers and corporate guys usually call the police, and more often than not, the choir gets arrested. In contrast, the Stop Shopping Choir was greeted with waves of applause when it performed the opening act for rock legend Neil Young's tour, The Monsanto Years. And in between receiving Obie and Alpert awards, the singers recently were arrested at the Spectra Pipeline and Flood Wall Street actions at Goldman Sachs. They also went to mountaintop removal coal mines and to the police station in Ferguson and work with Black Lives Matter. On April 26, 2016, New York-based Reverend Billy came as far west as he could possibly go and gave a performance/reading at the Gallery Bookshop in the village of Mendocino. One of the oldest independent bookstores in the country, separated from the Pacific Ocean by only the pavement of Main Street, a white picket fence, and the cliffs. Getting ready to record Reverend Billy, I saw two gray whales with newborns along their side travel north at a gentle pace. Reverend Billy introduced his new book, The Earth Wants You, as both a celebration of life and an indictment of the forces of destruction. He emerged from behind the Gallery Bookshop's broom closet in full clerical outfit, white suit, tab collar, and Elvis Presley pompadour hairdo. He felt a need to explain the Church of Stop Shopping, although he soon realized that he had one of the most responsive audiences of his book tour. Reverend Billy.
In the Church of Stop Shopping, we're all in recovery from fundamentalism of our grandparents, say. And we look like a New York subway car. Half of us are people of color. We're in recovery from Hinduism, Buddhism. We're Jews and Baptists and Catholics. But we consider consumerism the major fundamentalist church of our American culture.
Amen.
It regularizes our social behavior in absurdly thorough ways. Recently, I was on 580 in the East Bay, and I sat. You're not going to believe me. This is really absurd. I sat in a glass and metal bubble on a strip of smooth rock, and there were people sitting in glass and metal bubbles as far as the eye could see in front of me and as far as the eye could see in back of me. I was there with my little family, and we just sat there, and we didn't move for a long period of time. Now that is fundamentalism that competes with the 14th century Roman Catholic Church. That's fundamentalism, amen?
You can't move.
Well, while we're on the subject of transportation, I'd like to smoothly segue into this chapter. On the subway with Lena and Dad. I get on the train with Lena at the 15th Street Prospect Park Station. Anybody know where it is? Windsor Terrace, mm-hmm. Brooklyn? Amen. We descend the cold, clammy stairs and walk through the automatic doors into the train. At 5 years old, Lena immediately explores the personalities on the benches along the walls of the metal tube that screeches under New York. She knows, if she and her dad can sit side by side, that we can read a book on our trip to school, a 40-minute ride. Lena also knows that if we can squeeze in between two people and Dad can maneuver to stand over her in the strap-hanging crowd, steadying himself with one hand while reading her book upside down, she can still get her story. She knows by now that giving up your seat to a kid and a mom or a dad is standard child-friendly courtesy. Although, however, often unobserved. Lena sees, as I do, that no one is looking up. Seeing or even sensing us, the walls of the train are lined with commuters, given over to the complete and utter stillness of white wires in their ears and glowing screens in their hands. The train moves forward under the river. Are you excited?
Yes. Yeah.
I'm stopping myself from demanding seats for us. A little bit tempted. I search for an answer. What if Shakira and Lady Gaga and D'Angelo had a song called Look Up and Find a Child? What if these people on the train got on those headphones, got into those white wires and blasted this message of courtesy? What if we all re-entered the commons together as a result, reversing the stream of information? What if we just opened our eyes? And looking up, all of these folks would simply have the dynamics of a community facing them. We would say hello and do our musical chairs trading of positions. And we would be asking for the interdependency, the age-old understanding that we are ultimately raising our children together. Getting the attention of the screen frozen, that's a hyphenate phrase I made up myself, screen frozen,
good one.
Is as critical to any earth movement, as crucial, as the conversion of another community that doesn't see or hear too well. Cops. We have a cop problem in New York. And just when I have that thought about cops being a lot like these people that don't look up, two of New York's finest walk through the door at the Bergen Street Station. The police who arrest us on behalf of the glacier-melting bankers and those consumers who bow to the glowing screens, They cannot continue to act on the orders of the rich. They cannot. This must change. The Earth people must crack their codes, interrupt their habits, and coax new behavior out of them. Use humor, music, rapping, hacking, stilt walking, traffic jamming.
Puppets.
Use everything but violence to end the violence released by their compliance. Amen. Humility check, there is no they. Each of us is distanced from the earth by our own culture, and we all need all of the others to bring us back. This is an urgent politics, an education, a spiritual pivot. And for many of us, it will be, at first, a walk through a minefield of double takes, embarrassments, and WTFs. The silencing that is locked down upon us in corporate culture is very strict. The repetitive choreographies are precise and unchanging. The result is the censoring of those who would be our planet criers. So now we have the culture-wide inability to shout, emergency! If I break into this mass hypnosis with a shout, give my child a seat, will you people? I may be confronted by more subway rage. Subway rage, which claims lives every month in New York City. And I don't want rage of any kind for my prime witness, Lena. So what did we do? We read the book we took with us from home. I read it with some difficulty, out loud and standing up. But the book is so famous and so hip-hop rhythmic, I got into it and the volume of my voice rose, as it does with preachers. The book is The Lorax. Our morning read is turning into an Earthaluya nonviolence, but with wild, direct action. We flip the pages holding onto the silvery ceiling handles of the F-train, unraveling the story of the Barbalutes and the Swami Swans and the Truffula Trees. And what were those fish called? The humming fish. Who the once were forced to walk on their fins and get woefully weary in search of some water that isn't so smeary. What about the orangutans, Reverend? I can't believe what's happening to the orangutans. A young woman in a lime green flat top and Scotch skinny hipster pants looks up from her iPhone and says evenly, Reverend, I wasn't aware that orangutans are so near extinction. I love those lovelies with their long arms and their sad expressions. I know they must be smarter than 50% of the people on this train. It's kind of a New York comment. Yes, I reply, their habitat's disappearing, palm oil plantations, illegal logging. Those old hardwood trees. That's when Lena jumped on the young woman's lap, or tried to, and sort of hit her left knee. Because although the primate lover was into it, she didn't quite have the instincts for gathering a running and jumping kid into the lap area. But Lena got her place to sit, and the plaid stranger put her iPhone in her pocket in favor of the five-year-old. Another woman, and then a man, pulled off their headphones and signaled thank you to Lena and me for our performance. Lena had been singing along with the Lorax, matching my words like a second voice in a hip-hop song, because she has the whole book memorized. The cops were smiling. Probably parents themselves with Dr. Seuss recitations in their personal repertoire. Police can't officially say that they're Earth people. But being parents, they certainly have that chance, don't they? We look for how the Earth enters into our activism. The presence of personalities from the biosphere, in this case Dr. Seuss's wonderful animal inventions, was the Earth's cameo. They're underground in that train. Cops were a part of the story, too, the presence of armed enforcers of middle-class propriety. We pulled into the 2nd Avenue station and disembarked to walk the last blocks to Lena's school, she pumping with her leg out front on her purple scooter, but always stopping on the curb and waiting for me to catch up, panting, to cross the street holding hands. Wasn't this, quote, breaking into public space? That time-honored noble tradition of inappropriate behavior that attends all the successful social movements we've ever had in this country. performance of The Lorax was not a Disney production. It was physical. It was us. We performed for an audience with their ears wired to another story, and we dared them to be physical and present with us. And then the orangutan swinging through the minds of the trapped commuters on that train encouraged a young woman to take off her headphones. Her brash graciousness was ringing in our hands as we waited for the light. Amen. Amen. Hallelujah. You with me here?
Yeah. Happily so.
Happily so. Amen. This is called The Fabulous Unknown. The earth tells us to touch, learn, grow, change. Respond to others and never stop the music. Get that power from dancing in the streets. That collective joy. And then turn to face the devil again. The strongest human communication is love, because love makes life. You see, I'm imagining our evolution will recreate us as much more powerful Earth citizens. The Earth made our organism this way, after all. We are at the heart of evolution when we actively love each other. When we're actually making love. I'm starting to feel like Walt Whitman here. Hallelujah. Walt Whitman plus nonviolent direct action. Amen. Love is unknowable. With love, we are entering the fabulous unknown. One of the most revealing demonstrations of the horrible result of knowing everything comes to us from the Monsanto Corporation. That corporation believes it knows all there is to know about life on Earth and cannot imagine there's anything at all that's not replaceable. That is, all life on Earth can be genetically mapped and then copyrighted and owned, turned into a product for sale and possibly profit. In the Church of Stop Shopping, we know the love is unknowable, and we believe that the fabulous unknown is a wondrous thing that is at the heart of all our activism. This cannot be copyrighted or sold. Love cannot be known or replaced. Always start a new nonviolent direct action with mysterious love. Not strategy, not policy, not theory. Start with love. Kiss. And then follow the waves that go out from your lips. Fly with it. Like the bees, you will fly to justice. Replacement bees. Let's consider the honeybee. Honeybees have partnered with humans since the mists of prehistory, sharing its honey with us the way lovers share the honey of their bodies. The honeybee is a symbol of love in many of our songs. Many children's books have smiling honeybees. Amen. Here's a little known fact. You're not going to believe it. There are more bees on royal family coats of arms than lions and tigers and bears. Oh my.
Oh my.
The bee is here with us on this planet called the Earth, our partner. The honeybee is threatened now. 40% of all the bees in the United States, honeybees as well as thousands of wild bees, perished last year. Most beekeepers blame neonicotinoids that come to us from companies with names like Bayer, Syngenta, Monsanto, Dow, DuPont. Neonicotinoid pesticides, or neonics, are a best-selling insect killer, manufactured and sold under various names by these corporations I just recited to you. And just as it sounds, this class of poison is a fierce version of nicotine. It is a neuropathic substance. It short-circuits a sophisticated navigation system that directs bees from the hive to the discovery of distant flowers and back again. This tragedy is intensely sad. The bees are spiraling off, lost, flying vainly till they die of exhaustion miles away. They must feel a kind of loneliness. I wonder what that feels like to them. We can use our own sorrow turned into anger. That's a long hyphenated phrase. sorrow turned into anger, to stop the killing of the bees. It seems that Monsanto, Syngenta, and Bayer's plan is to replace the honeybee because the bee can't keep pace with the rising potency of their poisons. How can we allow them to end such life, to replace it with profits? How can we allow them to think that they could ever create a robot that could pollinate for their industry?
No, why would they want to?
Is that what they're doing?
Yes, it's called the RoboBee. They're spending millions and millions of dollars developing something called the RoboBee. Let us muse for a moment on the flight of the Apis mellifera, the honeybee. I am going to choose my odd words carefully. Let's start with the finding of just-bloomed flowers by the bee that scouts for the hive. The dancing language of the scout bee. She communicates a map to a new source of flowery nutrition miles from the hive, and it is miraculous. The scout bee, she travels miles away from the hive, mapping out the land. On her flight back from her reconnaissance journey, she is seen by sentry bees, and the hive is alerted. The scout prepares her report. As the sentry bees prepare the theater inside the hive. Amazing. The news will come in a performance for the buzzy audience inside the swirly ball of paper that we call the hive. Yes, they actually have stages inside those swirly gray paper medicine balls up in the trees. She dances. Let us count the ways. She emits pheromone-like perfumes. It's olfactory. There's a smelling. She drums with her feet and vibrates her abdomen under the hi-hat of her wings, which beat at 70 times a second. The choreographic line of her dance on the hive floor is a super precise compass needle pointing to the flower miles away. Her audience will eventually also know, but we don't know how this happens yet. There's a lot we don't know here. But her audience will also know how to go up over buildings, around hills. There's three-dimensional information here that the human scientists haven't figured out. But this is literally a language. Entomologists accept that the scout bee's dancing report is a language. And for years, human scientists resisted this idea because our chauvinistic species only wants intelligence in animals to manifest in cuties like dolphins, chimps, elephants. But now, the intelligence of the hive must be included in this pantheon. It has been discovered that this map-making dance performed inside the hive and affectionately called the waggle dance by entomologists, the waggle dance. And I'm just going to continue for the rest of this chapter to waggle for you. Affectionately called the waggle dance, but it triangulates. This is amazing. Check this out. The dance that she does triangulates the position of the sun with the spinning of the earth and the location of the destination hive. Wow. She makes a far better map than any GPS. Let's go deeper than this. Researchers recently noted that after the first waggle dance is completed, and that audience departs for the distant flowers, then another stage will be prepared for another dance in another part of the hive. When the scout bee prepares her report for the second audience, her geometry changes. Her language changes. Why? Exactly. The first dance report took about 20 minutes. To begin her second report, she makes an adjustment in her second dance, adjusts her percussion, her buzzing melodies, the pheromones, the angling dance, to account for the precise change in the relative positions of the earth and the sun in the hive. Honeybee-luia! Honeybee-luia! Damn! In the case of the honeybees, it seems that what is unknown to humans has been running the whole show for a long time. The Earth cannot be replaced because it is mostly unknown to us, and we can only extract, kill, copy, and replace that which is clearly understood. And what's that percentage? 1%?
No, maybe.
Maybe. Hopefully. Maybe not that. Let's say that 99% of the Earth looms around us unknown as we murder the plants and animals and murder each other. We have a chorus of elders who are singing the song of the unknown to us. Zora Neale Hurston's cherry tree blossoming and their eyes were watching God. Rachel Carson's undulating seaweed and somersaulting shells in the main tide pools. Edward Abbey hovering over the Colorado River as he starts Earth first. Federico Garcia Lorca in Spain writing his deep song around the night fire in Andalusia. Chief Joseph telling us that the Earth is the mother of all people and all people should have equal rights upon it. These wise ones perceive the unknown. They stand on the horizon of what they can sense and understand. Look out into creation and sing those words that guide us. There is an activist power in unknowable nature. We want to save the bees because we revere their mysterious whirling hives. How the thousands of bees pursue the good of the hive. How these creatures hover and buzz, making decision after decision. The endless interlocking moves, the mass making its survival together. Can we do that? We feel a swarming coming on. We are in Monsanto's lobby. We're on the roof. We're at their stockholders' convention, in their minds. We are swarming. We are creating the miracle. We're emitting the pheromones. Our wings are beating 70 times a second. And the former Blackwater USA officials that Monsanto hires for security who study us must know that we have our own waggle dance. We are designed by the sun and the earth and our brothers and sisters in the hive. And at the end of their notes in the file they keep on us, the corporate cops must add that we, activists, are unknowable, too.
Woo! Great writing.
That was Reverend Billy, a.k.a. Bill Talon, off the New York City-based Church of Stop Shopping. I recorded him in April 2016 at the third stop of his tour after the publication of his City Lights book, The Earth Needs You. He performed at the Gallery Bookshop in Mendocino Village on the Pacific Coast. Talon is the author of several books, including What Would Jesus Buy? And What Should I Do If Reverend Billy Is in My Store? Much more information is on the website of the Church of Stop Shopping at revbilly.com. City Lights books are at citylights.com. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio is free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org, for the address and donate buttons. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Mariah Gelaiden. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Do people over a certain age necessarily lose their mental acuity? According to Dr. Gene Cohen, the answer is no. Dr. Cohen, a psychiatrist and gerontologist, has determined that certain genes are activated by experience as we age, allowing our personalities to grow and change. The brain has reserves of strength and agility that compensate for the effects of aging on its other parts. Dr. Cohen has found that the information processing center in the 60 to 80-year-old brain achieves its greatest density and reach. He explains these and other developing concepts in brain research in his book, The Mature Mind: The Positive Power of the Aging Brain. I spoke with Dr. Cohen in March of 2006 from his office at the Center on Aging, Health, and Humanities in Washington, D.C., where he is the director. We began our conversation with his description of the importance of the role of creativity.
Well, in my book, The Creative Age, I addressed this and looked at the body of research in that area. What emerges is a lot of interesting mind-body findings, that when you're involved in creative endeavors, the outcome is what they refer to as psychoneuroimmunologic reaction, where your immune system gets a bit of a boost influenced by the mind.
Why is that?
Well, it's really part of the way the body is set up. We're biopsychosocial creatures, and what that indicates is that there are connections between our different systems, and it's a very elaborate and successful system for promoting health. I also just have completed a major study supported by the National Endowment for the Arts looking at the impact of community-based art programs for older persons. So this is community-based creative activities through the form of art.
Well, I would think that the operative word is creative activities as opposed to art in terms of drawing or perhaps music.
Yes, creative activities is a much more inclusive category. And one example is getting involved with art. This particular study, which is called the Creativity and Aging Study, looked at one form of creative expression, and that was involvement in different art forms. And the results were really quite remarkable. The average age in the study was 80, and this was both with the participants in the art programs and the control group. And what these people revealed, for those who were involved in the art programs, was a stabilization and actually improvement in different areas of health, improvement on different mood scales, loneliness and morale, and an actual increase in activities during the course of the study, and as opposed to the control group that did less well in all those areas.
In a project that foments creativity, what is it that the active mind draws from that yields better health, physical as well as mental?
Well, one of the phenomena that's going on, and this was part of the theoretical background for the study that I just described, is a large body of research that's called sense of control. That when you're in situations where you have a sense of control or mastery or competency, and particularly when this is new, this mind-body reaction that I described happens, this triggering of a positive response in the immune system. And so this was part of the theoretical background of that study. And creative activities are activities that very strongly give you a new sense of mastery and accomplishment. And to the extent that you continue to be involved with them, then it's as if you get repeated booster shots in terms of their effect in that mind-body sense.
The production of the creative activity draws on the memory, which is a collective consciousness and sometimes unconscious memory, as you describe in your book.
Well, another factor related to that is the challenge of activities like that. Often creative endeavors are very challenging. And the whole field of behavioral neuroscience has developed around the discovery that when we challenge the mind, it has very positive effects on the brain. The latest finding in that regard is that mental challenge actually produces new brain cells. We used to be taught that we had all of our brain cells by 3. We now know that that's not true. It continues throughout the life cycle, and challenge is a key factor.
As long as people are alive, new brain cells are generating?
Yes. Yes, and environmental challenge is a key factor. And in addition to the positive impact of challenge on generating new cells, the existing cells also are very significantly affected. Brain cells have the capacity to sprout new extensions. They're called dendrites. And a given brain cell can literally sprout hundreds or thousands of these branch-like extensions. It's really quite remarkable. And the biggest influence on sprouting new dendrites, these new extensions, is challenge. And when you sprout new dendrites, it creates new connections between different brain cells, enhancing communication, improving memory processing, memory storage, and the overall functioning of the mind. It's a very powerful effect, and this is what we can do ourselves.
In your research, you indicate that people can self-actuate this, but do you find that there are some personality types where it's easier to do this?
Well, it's more of a factor of issues like motivation. All personality types show creative potential. Whether you're an introvert or an extrovert, it's often different types of creativity. But it's more, rather than hardware issues like personality, more software type issues such as motivation, sticking to it, perseverance. And these are factors that can be developed.
Learn behavior?
Yes, learn behavior.
Your hypothesis is that older adults can learn new patterns of behavior that they didn't necessarily have before.
Yes, not only that, but in my book, The Mature Mind, I describe new phases of psychological development. These new phases create new opportunities for discovering new aspects of yourself. They influence confidence levels in yourself. For example, one of the phases that I describe is the liberation phase, and this begins to kick in around the mid-50s, strong mid-late 50s, throughout the 60s, early to mid-70s. And it's as if you have these metaphorical, friendly inner voices saying to you, if not now, when? Why not? What can they do to me? And these are powerful, liberating feelings that are part of a psychological change that's going on during that stage of life where you have a new sense of confidence and comfort level with trying something, this new inner sense of freedom to experiment in new directions, and that's why I refer to this as the liberation phase. And it influences many late bloomers. You know, the field of folk art is dominated by older persons, and many of these people only first became serious about their folk art in later life, and I feel this is related to the liberation phase.
Why do you feel that the liberation phase comes about in the later years?
Well, throughout life, I mean, it is part of the human condition that we want to try things and we want to experiment. But at different times of life, it appears in different ways. There's a lot of experimentation during adolescence. And in many ways, the liberation phase is related to that, but with a big difference. And the liberation phase, because of the process of aging, you've developed a much better sense of who you are, a confidence level, a comfort level in yourself. And so this affects decisions that you make, actions that you choose to take. And so there's a lot more judgment and perspective on trying something new in the liberation phase. I feel this is all related to the broader issue of creativity, which I see is built into the species. And what I describe as related to this is what I call the inner push. This is the push that makes us want to climb mountains. It makes a toddler look at a staircase as if it's a mountain, and despite falling many, many, many times, they want to climb it. And that inner push operates throughout the life cycle. But as we continue to grow, and since we now know that all experience alters the brain is constantly changing. And so I feel that over time, the changing of the brain itself in terms of its structure in combination with accumulating life experience alters the way that the inner push shows itself. And so that's why the four psychological growth phases I described in the later life, I feel are different manifestations of the inner push influenced by the process of aging in a psychosocial sense, but also in a neurobiological sense through the ongoing changes in the brain.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're talking with Dr. Eugene Cohen from his office in Washington, D.C. Dr. Cohen is the author of The Mature Mind, The Positive Power of the Aging Brain. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Dr. Cohen, you say that this is built into the species. Yet if we go back in the history of our species a short time, perhaps 5,000 years, people didn't live as long then as they do now. Is this a consistent unintended consequence, or does it indicate something else that's built into our species from an evolutionary sense?
Well, there are very new views in terms of the benefit of aging in an evolutionary sense, a survival benefit. Traditionally, for so long, survival was only viewed in terms of reproductive capacity, that once you lost your capacity to reproduce, your impact on survival of the species greatly diminished. But a whole new body of research has emerged, both socially and biologically, to look at the view of aging in a survival context. First of all, the older members of the species, over the history of civilization and even before civilization, were reservoirs of information that helped people better negotiate their environment. New studies on different groups of dolphins and whales show the grandparents, female grandparents, breastfeeding the grandchildren as the adult parents are operating in terms of broader food gathering, protection of the their family. And so this is a quite interesting biological example of older members of the species continuing to the survival of the species.
Yeah, you're talking about brain changes in people beginning around age 60, more or less. But 5,000 years ago, 40 was considered to be very old. Did these brain changes occur then at an earlier age?
Probably, to the extent that you're talking about Homo sapiens. You know, in even very recently, life expectancy was much lower than it was. In the United States, in the year 1900, life expectancy was under 50 years. But that didn't mean there weren't older people. There were always people who lived to a more advanced age, but just average longevity was diminished. And then there was the great surge in average longevity called life expectancy in the 20th century, where it went from under 50 to greater than 75 years. But brain changes are occurring all the time. And basically, the latest findings from neuroscience show that whenever you challenge your brain, any experience alters the brain. Any challenge or experience is altering the production of new dendrites, the branch-like extensions from brain cells, and they're forming new synapses, which are the contact points between cells. And this happens throughout all of development. Early on, people thought that that major process of dendritic sprouting and the formation of new synapses in particular was just the product of early built-in development. But now we realize that learning and challenge has the same impact on the nervous system in terms of sprouting of new dendrites and formation of new synapses between cells that built-in developmental forces have.
How were those realizations brought to the forefront? How did they become understood?
They were initially discovered in animal studies that began in the mid-60s. And the way these studies were designed is you would have two groups of laboratory rats, one in a typical environment and the other in a more challenged environment. And after a period of time went by, the brains of the rats were compared. And the challenged rats showed a significant increase in the production of new dendrites, new synapse formation, the production of cells called glial cells. These are cells that nourish neurons of brain cells. Einstein's brain, on autopsy, showed a greater than average number of glial cells. The challenged animals had an increased number of glial cells. And then when they continued these studies to focus on the older animals, they found, regardless of age, all of these what are referred to as brain plasticity changes continued independent of age. And this began a profound revolution in our understanding of the neuroscience of aging. At one level, it validated folk advice, which was use it or lose it. But modern neuroscience took folk advice a step further and showed that there's no age limit to using it to alter losing it.
In your studies, have you found that there are any particular times when a person is more likely to benefit from learning than at other times?
I find that the desire to learn really continues through the life cycle, and I just completed a retirement study that I began in 2000, and these were people between 60 and over 90 years of age. Virtually every person in the study wanted to continue learning, take courses of different times. And this is, of course, one of the reasons that Elder Hostel, as an educational program for older adults, has just boomed. And this desire to learn is just very, very strong, and it continues throughout the life cycle.
Dr. Gene Cohen, author of The Mature Mind, what happened in your life in your younger years that led you down this path of study?
Well, it's a little hard to say. All the way back into high school, I was interested in issues of aging. Aging has two parts to it. There's the older person part, the elderly, and there's also the process of aging itself, which starts right from the beginning of from birth, or even prior to birth. And when I was in high school, I actually won first place in the Massachusetts MIT State Science Fair with a project on aging. It was a study of age growth in fish. And then after I completed my medical training and training in psychiatry, I had the good fortune of being at the National Institute of Mental Health, and there, based on work that I had actually started during my residency in psychiatry and working with older people, I was asked to head the first center on mental health and aging that was set up at the Institute in 1975.
With the information that you've gathered, where do we go from here? How do we start this instruction that you feel is important with younger people so that by the time they're seniors, they're able to employ it more quickly?
A number of parts to that question. Let me just mention a couple. In the broad view, there's a major conceptual change going on in how we're looking at aging. And in the past 30 years, there have been two major sea changes in thinking. One was happening in the mid-70s when the program, for example, that I mentioned that I was asked to head took place. And in the mid-70s, for the first time, people were developing hypotheses for problems associated with aging. And so rather than seeing negative changes with aging as being inevitable in our destiny, the question increasingly rose that maybe a lot of these changes aren't aging per se, but problems associated with aging. And this launched the field of geriatrics, which soared during the 1980s. Now I feel we're at the second major turning point, and that is looking beyond problems to potential. For the first time, we're looking at what's possible with aging. And unless you have an added focus on potential possibility, you deprive yourself of a true opportunity for health promotion and prevention. And this is the big change that's happening now.
What is possible with aging?
Anything. It's never too late to change. It's never too late to accomplish something. There are many people who have illustrated this. The Delaney sisters, these two charming African-American sisters who described their relationship as probably having been the longest that anybody had. Delaney was 105 when she collaborated with her sister, Bessie Delaney, who was 103, to write an autobiography. And it was called The Delaney Sisters, The First 100 Years. And it became a New York Times bestseller, and then it became a Broadway show. And so it just was an incredible celebration of possibility of life with great longevity. George Abbott, impressive enough that he wrote Damn Yankees when he was 68, but he revised it when he was 107.
Within the physiology of the brain, you talk about the limbic system and how it's related to the cortex and the effect and origins of positive and negative emotions.
Yes.
Can you describe how that fits the greater study that we're talking about?
Yeah, it's a fascinating finding. One of the brain structures within the limbic system is called the amygdala, and it's the part of the brain that processes emotions. And what has been found recently in brain imaging studies with the amygdala, and the way these are set up in terms of studying emotions, you have a group of younger adults and a group of older adults, and you expose them to different emotions. And in this particular study I'm going to describe, they were exposed to positive emotions and negative emotions. Positive emotions such as love, joy, happiness. Negative emotions such as fear, anger, envy. And in response to positive emotions, the young adults and the older adults alike lit up the amygdala with the same intensity, and that intensity persisted for essentially the same length of time. But with negative emotions, in the older adults, the amygdala lit up less intensely and dissipated faster. So it really reflects an extraordinary brain change, which I feel is a protective, adaptive change that enables a lot of people to handle better the increased adversity that they experience with aging. And I feel it helps explain the many morale studies which have been done comparing older adults and younger adults. And older adults, despite extensive frailty or challenge or problems they've had, score just as well and often higher on morale assessments than do younger adults. This has typically been explained psychosocially as a factor of throughout life you develop a perspective and you adapt to different situations. But these new findings show that in addition to that, there's this powerful neurobiological effect of the amygdala starting to screen out more negative emotions rather than positive ones.
Yet there may be some people who have such overwhelming negative emotions that they don't live to old age, so they cannot be included in the study.
Sure. There are always people that would sort of fit into that category. But in these controlled studies where you take large groups of people and you compare the old to the young in a controlled sense, these studies have consistently revealed that a growing number of these studies have been done, and they have been repeated in a number of different forms. It's an increasingly accepted and fascinating finding, and one of a large number of ways that the brain adapts with aging. Just an extraordinary change.
In preparing for retirement, you talk about the importance of physical health, active mental health, active social health. How do you see the future, particularly for the baby boomers?
Well, fortunately, the baby boomers are used to getting their way. And the baby boomers, I feel, are unique in history in a way that really hasn't been discussed. Baby boomers are the first major group historically that has grown up with a lot of positive images of aging. Many of their parents are accomplishing things at remarkable levels. And so the boomers are the first group that have had parents aging long and well. And so they've seen for the first time of any group what's possible with aging. And that has been telling them what's possible with their own aging. And as they see what can be, they start to think, this is what should be. This is what should be for me. And so I feel that this new understanding and these new expectations are going to have a very significant effect on social policy.
Your point, what they see can be, and that should be for them, that goes to the fundamentals, it seems, of learning and memory and application to oneself.
Right. Very much so. And the whole area of aging, the stereotypes, negative stereotypes and myths are falling by the wayside because people are, for the first time, seeing what's truly possible, and it's very different from the story that people have been brought up with. If you have a negative view of aging, you deny it. You don't prepare for it. You don't have a sense of confidence that if you do something, you'll have positive results. And so it interferes with individual motivation. It interferes with the motivation of significant others around us who, if they had expectations in this area that were positive, they would nudge us the same way parents nudge children when they see possibilities that the children don't see. Communities had a better sense as to what was possible, this would affect more creative program planning for older members and their families, and similarly with policymakers. If they had a better vision in terms of what was possible, the new true picture of aging, it would influence more enlightened social policy. We're just starting to move in that direction because this whole focus on potential is very new.
Dr. Gene Cohen, author of The Mature Mind, The Positive Power of the Aging Brain, thanks for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
I read a book that many have read, Tuesdays with Mari. It's a wonderful, inspirational book. One thing, though, that it doesn't have is a life cycle perspective to show what the impact of different conditions are at different stages of life. And this is what makes, to me, the study of aging and looking at different periods of psychological growth and experience so important, is to see how the same events are experienced at different points in the life cycle.
Dr. Gene Cohen, thanks for being with us on Radio Curious.
My pleasure.
Dr. Gene Cohen is the author of The Mature Mind, The Positive Power of the Aging Brain. He is also the director of the Center on Aging, Health, and Humanities in Washington, D.C. The book he recommends is Tuesdays with Mori, An Old Man, a Young Man, and Life's Greatest Lesson by Mitch Alborn. Curious has over 600 archive editions on our website, radiocurious.org, with new editions published regularly. You may stream, download, subscribe to our podcast service, and share them as you wish. They're all free. We appreciate your thoughts, ideas, and comments about our programs and enjoy hearing from you. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. The phone is 707-462-6541. And the address is 280 North Oak Street, Ukiah, UKIAH, California, 95482. Christina Onnested and Yuko Kodama are the assistant producers. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.